Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Revealed new information about what the Florida shooting suspect did immediately before and after the attack at the school. Their timeline starts at 2:19 yesterday afternoon, and they are still interviewing witnesses. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Lisa Hughes.
And I'm David Wade. We are learning that there were major red flags that were raised about the alleged gunman. That 19-year-old is now being held tonight. Police say he used an AR-15 rifle to carry out the attack and posted very disturbing images and messages on social media. The FBI says that they were warned about a violent message online under the name Nicholas Cruz months ago, and people who knew him say he was unstable and violent.
All 17 of the victims have been identified. Their families released photographs today, and tonight thousands of people are expected to gather for a vigil in their memory. Our team coverage begins tonight with WBZ's Cheryl Fiandaca live in studio with new information on the investigation. Cheryl.
Well, Lisa, David, police say Nicholas Cruz made statements to investigators. The picture now becoming increasingly clear. A history of killing animals, a fascination with guns and knives, threats to the school, and mental health issues. But no one pieced it all together.
Are you Nicholas Jacob Cruz?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, sir, you are charged with 17 counts of premeditated murder.
In handcuffs and shackles, wearing an orange jail jumpsuit, Nicholas Jacob Cruz faced a judge in a Florida courtroom.
You're going to be held without bond.
We are now learning more about the timeline of the shooting. Police say Cruz opened fire on several floors in the school before exiting with other students who were running for their lives. Cruz ran toward the tennis courts, arrived at Walmart, bought a drink at Subway, went on to McDonald's, and after leaving McDonald's, police found him and took him into custody without incident.
Over 2,000 people were interviewed, and we continue. This is a fluid investigation.
An investigation that has already revealed some of Cruz's troubling past. The 19-year-old was expelled from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Police say he took an Uber to his old school carrying a loaded AR-15. His attorney says Cruz has a history of mental illness.
He's a broken human being. He's a broken child.
And we've also learned he was a member of a white supremacy group and posted photos of guns, knives, and dead animals on social media. Today, the FBI admitted it got a tip last year that Cruz posted on YouTube, "I'm going to be a professional shooter."
No other information was included with that comment, which would indicate a time, location, or the true identity of the person who made the comment.
The school superintendent has said they had no warning of yesterday's shooting, and the leader of the white supremacy group told the Anti-Defamation League it did not order or want the school shooting. David, Lisa.
All right.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, February 16th, 2018. So I have been told after a two-month hiatus, the book club returns. Unfortunately, my residence was flooded at the moment that we were reading a book that I have thoroughly enjoyed, Mr. Kevin Dutton, The Wisdom of Psychopaths, What Sadists, Spies, and Serial Killers can teach us about success. Suspected racist, Kevin Dutton. We got cut off. We had read about two-thirds of the book. I think we have a couple chapters left to go, and had the huge break disconnect in reading. I'm sure listeners might have lost track or forgotten what we read and covered before. It is in the archives. You can kind of go back and refresh. If you have the book, it's, you know, super easy. You can just kind of go back and look over what you highlighted, and I'm sure it'll jog your memory quickly. But The Wisdom of Psychopaths, some of the main themes, just a quick refresher. Some of the main themes I've said, he has not really referenced black people in this book. Pretty much all of the examples that have been used have been white people from different parts of the world. And in my opinion, the giddiness, the glee that Mr. Dutton shows in his writing, in talking about all of these serial killers, murderers, violent individuals, violent whites, like Nicholas Cruz, because we started reading this book, Charles Manson had just died, and he gets mentioned in the book, and Jeffrey Dahmer, it just seems like glorifying white killers, Chris Kyle, American Sniper type thing all over again. But that's one of the major, major points that I've talked about. And again, the work of Dr. Bobby E. Wright, Psychopathic Racial Personality and Other Essays. I think that's hugely important to keep in mind. I think this book reveals so much about what it means to be white, courtesy of Dr. Niana Rasayan, who recommended this book in the first place. I think it is apropos that the week that we return with the book club and The Wisdom of Psychopaths, Nicholas Cruz, another fine illustration of white psychopathy, what it means to be white. And then you got the little added snippet in there, explicit, him, his ties, his connections to this, what they call white nationalist, white supremacist organization. Make it plain. We will go ahead and get started. We're on chapter six. Chapter six, Mr. Kevin Dutton's The Wisdom of Psychopaths, Context of White Supremacy.
Chapter six, The Seven Deadly Wins. Sentiment is a chemical aberration found on the losing side. Sherlock Holmes. Crossing the border. The joke is that it's harder to get into Broadmoor than out, but it isn't. A joke, that is. Got anything sharp? The woman at reception barks as I deposit the entire contents of my briefcase. Laptop, phone, pens, yes, my trusty Glock 17 pistol, into a plexiglass-fronted locker in the entrance hall. Only my wit, I reply, parodying Oscar Wilde's one-time comment to a U.S. customs official. The receptionist isn't a fan, either of myself or, it appears, of Oscar. It's not that sharp, Sonny, she shoots back. Now place the index finger of your right hand here and look up at the camera. Once you pass through border control at Broadmoor, you're immediately ushered into a tiny security airlock, a temporary glass-walled holding cell between reception and the hospital building proper, while the person you're visiting gets buzzed by reception and makes their way over to meet you. It's an unnerving, claustrophobic wait. As I flick through the magazines, I remind myself why I'm here, an email I'd received after launching the Great British Psychopath Survey. The survey is unique, the first of its kind, to assess the prevalence of psychopathic traits within an entire national workforce. Participants were directed onto my website, where they completed the Levinson Self-Report Psychopathy Scale and were then given their score. But that wasn't all. They also entered their employment details. What would turn out to be the UK's most psychopathic profession? I wanted to know. And, for that matter, its least. The results are certainly interesting, especially if you're partial to a sermon or two on a Sunday. More psychopathic. 1. CEO. 2. Lawyer. 3. Media, TV/radio. 4. Salesperson. 5. Surgeon. 6. Journalist. 7. Police officer. 8. Clergyperson. 9. Chef. 10. Civil servant. less psychopathic. 1. Care aide. 2. Nurse. 3. Therapist. 4. Craftsperson. 5. Beautician / stylist. 6. Charity worker. 7. Teacher. 8. Creative artist. 9. Doctor. 10. Accountant. Then, a couple of weeks later, the following appeared in my inbox from one of the survey's respondents. He's a barrister by trade, indeed one of the UK's finest, who'd posted a score that certainly got my attention. Yet to him, it's nothing unusual. No big deal whatsoever. I realized from quite early on in my childhood that I saw things differently from other people, he wrote. But more often than not, it's helped me in my life. Psychopathy, if that's what you want to call it, is like a medicine for modern times. If you take it in moderation, it can prove extremely beneficial. It can alleviate a lot of existential ailments that we would otherwise fall victim to because our fragile psychological immune systems just aren't up to the job of protecting us. But if you take too much of it, if you overdose on it, then there can, as is the case with all medicines, be some rather unpleasant side effects. The email had got me thinking. Might this eminent criminal defense lawyer have a point? Was psychopathy a medicine for modern times? Could taking it in moderation, twiddling those dials a little to the right on our respective psychopath mixing desks at certain times in certain specific contexts, actually be good for us? It was an interesting possibility, and moreover, it made a lot of intuitive sense. Let's take a look at those dials for a moment. Ruthlessness, charm, focus, mental toughness, fearlessness, mindfulness, living in the moment, and action. Who wouldn't, at certain points in their lives, benefit from kicking one or two of them up a notch? What was important was being able to turn them back down. I decided to put the theory to test. Not quite to destruction, but it was sure as hell going to be close. I had a visit to several hospitals coming up to interview some colleagues. But what if I went on the wards? What if, as well as meeting the doctors, I talked with some of the patients, presented them with problems from normal, everyday life, the usual stuff we moan about at happy hour, and see what their take on it was? See what suggestions they happened to come up with. Up until now, it had seemed like a good idea. Professor Dutton? My train of thought is broken, and I look up to see a blonde guy in his mid-30s peering around the door at me. Hi, I'm Richard Blake, one of the team leaders of the Paddock Center. Welcome to Broadmoor. Shall I take you over? As we weigh anchor and begin charting our course deeper and deeper into the mazy medicinal bowels of the hospital, through a series of interconnecting corridors and no-man's-land antechambers just like the one we started out from, security air bubbles, as Richard calls them. The golden rule in Broadmoor is never open any door in front of you before first making sure that the one behind is locked. He tells me, in a little bit more detail, about where we're going. The Paddock Center is an enclosed, highly specialized personality disorder directorate comprising 6 12-bedded wards. Around 20% of the patients housed there at any one time are what you might call pure psychopaths, and these are confined to 2 dedicated wards specifically assigned to their treatment and continual assessment, the Dangerous and Severe Personality Disorder, DSPD, wards. The rest present with so-called cluster disorders, clinically significant psychopathic traits, as evidenced by moderately high PCLR scores, accompanied by the presence of core supplementary traits typically associated with other certifiable personality disorders, borderline, paranoid, and narcissistic, for example. Or, alternatively, traits more indicative of primary psychotic symptomology, delusions and hallucinations being the obvious cases in point. Suddenly, reality dawns. This is no drop-in center for the mocha-sipping worried well I'm about to enter into. This is the lair, the conscienceless inner sanctum of the Chianti-swilling unworried unwell. the preserve of some of the most sinister neurochemistry in the business, where brain states can quite literally teeter on a knife edge. The Yorkshire Ripper is in here. So is the Stockwell Strangler. It's one of the most dangerous buildings on Earth. I am going to be all right, aren't I, Richard? I squeak as we suddenly emerge to the right of a large open-air enclosure, topped off with some distinctly uncooperative razor wire. He grins. You'll be fine, he says. Actually, trouble on the DSPD wards is relatively rare. Psychopathic violence is predominantly instrumental, a direct means to a specific end, which means, in an environment like this, that it's largely preventable, and in the event that something does kick off, easily contained. It's on the psychotic wards that things are less predictable. In fact, even when compared with other personality disorders, psychopaths are easier to deal with. For some reason, they tend to respond better to daily activities than, say, borderlines or paranoids. Maybe it's because of their low boredom threshold. They like to keep themselves amused. Besides, he adds, with just the merest hint of reproach, it's a bit late to turn back now, isn't it? Getting to know the locals. We are the evil elite, says Danny as he slams in his second goal for Chelsea, a belter of a header from right smack on the edge of the six-yard area. Don't glamorize us, but at the same time, don't go the other way and start dehumanizing us either. He shoots me a glance from behind his Nintendo Wii. Things are going well, both on and off the field. Chelsea are up 2-0 against Manchester United, and I'm sitting watching in the company of a bunch of psychopaths, feet up on a table, in the corner of one of Broadmoor's ultra-sequestered DSPD wards. The vibe in the ward isn't what I'm expecting. My first impression is of an extremely well-appointed college dormitory. All blonde, clean-shaven wood, voluminous, freshly squeezed light, and mathematically defibrillated space. There's even a pool table, I notice, which today, unfortunately, it would have been nice to have clawed back my train fare, has a sheet over it. Larry, a gray, bewhiskered, roly-poly kind of guy who, in a fair aisle sweater and beige stretch slacks, looks like everyone's favorite uncle, except that if you were planning on going out for the evening, you'd be better off hiring Herod as a babysitter, takes a shine to me. He's had enough of the football. You know, he says, as he shakes my hand and silently impales me on his somnolent, moonlit stare, they say I'm one of the most dangerous men in Broadmoor. Can you believe that? But I promise I won't kill you. Here, let me show you around. Larry escorts me to the far end of the ward, where we stop to take a peek inside his room. It's the same, pretty much, as any other single-occupancy room you might find in a hospital, though with a few more creature comforts, like a computer, for instance, and desk space, and a raft of books and papers on the bed. Sensing, perhaps, my inchoate curiosity, he draws a little closer. I've been in for 20 years, he sibilates in my ear. That's a hell of a lot of time to... He clears his throat and smiles conspiratorially. Have on your hands. Are you with me? Next station down is the garden, a sunken, gray-bricked patio affair about the size, give or take, of a tennis court, interspersed with benches and conifers. Verdict? Gets a bit samey after 20 years. Fair enough. We then venture over to the opposite side of the ward. The layout of the place is symmetrical. 6 rooms on one side, 6 on the other, separated in the middle by a well-vacuumed ash-gray meridian, and drop in on Jamie. This guy's from Cambridge University, announces Larry, and he's in the middle of writing a book on us. Jamie stands up and heads us off at the door. It's a clear invitation for us to kindly retrace our steps, which we do rather quickly, back into the sanctuary of the ward. Jamie, it transpires, is a completely different proposition from Larry. A monster of a man at around 6'2", with brutal, char-grilled stubble and a piercing cobalt stare, he has the brooding, menacing, sub-satanic presence of the lone, ultra-violent killer. The lumberjack shirt and shaven wrecking ball head don't exactly help matters.
"So what's this book about, then?"
he growls in a gangsterish Cockney whisper, wedged into the doorframe of his room, arms folded in front of him, left fist jammed like a ball hammer under his chin.
"Same old bollocks, I suppose. Lock him up and throw away the key? You know, you've got no idea how vindictive that can sound at times. And, might I add, downright hurtful. Has he, Larry?"
Larry guffaws theatrically and clasps his hands to his heart in a Shakespearean display of angst. Jamie, meanwhile, dabs at imaginary tears. "This is great. Precisely what I came here for. Such stoic irreverence in the face of unremitting adversity is something, perhaps, we could all do with a little bit more of."
"You know what, Jamie," I say, "I'm trying to do exactly the opposite. I happen to think that you guys have got something to teach us, a certain personality style that the rest of us can learn from, in moderation, of course. That's important. Like the way, just now, you shrugged off what people might think of you. In everyday life, there's a level on which that's actually quite healthy."
Jamie seems quite amused by the idea that I might be soliciting his advice, that the polarized vantage point of a psychopath might, in actual fact, offer some valuable perspective on the dilemmas of everyday life. But he's still a little circumspect.
"Are you saying that me and Captain McAllister here have just got too much of a good thing?" he sneers. "That the car's pretty cool, but the driver's too fast for the road?"
It's an interesting analogy.
"Kind of," I say. "You interested in taking your foot off the gas and pulling over for a minute?"
Jamie's eyes narrow.
"I ain't pulling over for no one," he shoots back. "But if you fancy a ride, hop in."
Back where we started, down at the other end of the ward, Chelsea are now four ahead of United, and Danny, who else, has just been named man of the match.
"I see he hasn't killed you then," he says casually, throwing a quick glance in Captain McAllister's direction. "You going soft in your old age, Larry?"
I laugh, more than a little nervously, I realize. There's a healthy tinge of mania in my chortling, but Larry is deadly serious.
"Hey," he says insistently, "you don't get it, do you, boy? I said I wouldn't kill you, and I didn't, right?"
Suddenly, it dawns on me that Larry may not have been bluffing, may well have been exerting a touch more self-control than appearances might have suggested, and that my nervous discomfiture and attempt to laugh it off has, far from achieving that noble and laudable aim, succeeded in getting his back up.
"No, I do, Larry," I pipe up.
"Get it, really. Thanks, man. It's very much appreciated." Jamie smiles. He obviously finds it funny. But from the precariously thin ice that I now appear to be skating on, it's no laughing matter at all. It's easy to forget that anything is possible with these guys, that there really are no limits, and that with no moral brake pads and a V12 amygdala, it doesn't take much for the car to spin off the road. The curtain comes down on the football, and Danny zaps it off. He leans back in his chair.
"So a book, huh?" he says.
"Yes," I say. "I'm interested in the way you guys solve problems." Danny eyes me quizzically.
"What kind of problems?" he asks.
"Everyday problems," I say. "You know, the kind most people have to deal with in their lives." I glance at Larry and Jamie.
"Mind if I give you an example?"
Danny looks at the clock.
"Why not?" he sighs. "As long as it doesn't take longer than 5 years."
"I'll try to keep it brief," I say. "And tell him about some friends of mine who are trying to sell their house." Ruthlessness. How to get rid of an unwanted tenant. That was the question for Don and his wife, Fran, who'd just had Fran's elderly mother, Flo, move in with them. Flo had lived in her previous house for 47 years, and now that she no longer needed it, Don and Fran had put it on the market. Being in London, in an up-and-coming area,
there was quite a bit of interest, but also a bit of a problem. The tenant, who wasn't exactly ecstatic at the prospect of hitting the road. Don and Fran were pretty much at the end of their tether. They'd already lost out on one potential sale because he couldn't or wouldn't pack his bags. Another might prove disastrous. But how to get him out? I'm presuming we're not talking violence here, inquires Danny, right? Right, I say. We wouldn't want to end up inside, now would we? Danny gives me the finger. But the very fact that he asks such a question at all debunks the myth that violence, for psychopaths, is the only club in the bag.
How about this, then? Rumbles Jamie. With the old girl up at her in-laws, chances are the geezer's going to be alone in the house, yeah? So he opposes some bloke from the council, turn up at the door and ask to speak to the owner. He answers and tells you the old deer ain't in. Okay, you say, not a problem. But have you got a forwarding contact number for her? Because you need to speak to her urgently. By this stage, he's getting kind of curious. What's up? He asks a bit wary-like. Actually, you say quite a lot. You've just been out front and taken a routine asbestos reading. And guess what? The level's so high it makes Chernobyl look like a health spa. The owner of the property needs to be contacted immediately. A structural survey has to be carried out, and anyone currently living at the address needs to vacate the premises until the council can give her the all clear. That should do the trick. With a bit of luck, before you can say slow, torturous death from lung cancer, the wanker will be straight out the door. Of course, you could just change the locks when he nips out down to the local, I suppose. That'd be kind of funny. But the problem is, you've still got all his gear. Which I guess is okay if you're planning on having a garage sale. I mean, you could even make a few quid out of the jerk and cover the cost of the locks. Me, though? I go the health and safety route personally. Stealth and safety, more like. You'd get shot of the bastard completely that way, I reckon. Plus, of course, he'd think you were doing him a favor.
Jamie's elegant, if rather unorthodox, solution to Don and Fran's stay-at-home tenant conundrum certainly had me beat. But there was, in my defense, a perfectly good reason for that, of course. I'm not a ruthless psychopath. The idea of getting the guy out so fast as to render him homeless and on the streets just simply hadn't occurred to me. It just hadn't been on my radar. Neither, for that matter, had selling all his possessions to pay for the pleasure of locking him out of the house. And yet, as Jamie quite rightly pointed out, there are times in life when it's a case of the least worst option. When sometimes, in order to achieve the desired or most favorable outcome, you've got to do what you've got to do. But there's more. Interestingly, he argues it's actually the right thing to do. From an objective point of view, the ethical course of action.
Why not turf the bastard out? He asks. I mean, think about it. You talk about doing the right thing. But what's worse, from a moral perspective, beating someone up who deserves it, or beating yourself up who doesn't? If you're a boxer, you do everything in your power to put the other guy away as soon as possible, right? So why are people prepared to tolerate ruthlessness in sport, but not in everyday life? What's the difference? The problem with a lot of people is that what they think is a virtue is actually a vice in disguise. It's much easier to convince yourself that you're reasonable and civilized than soft and weak, isn't it? Men sleep peacefully in their beds at night, George Orwell once pointed out, because rough men stand ready to do violence on their behalf.
But perhaps, if one of the world's most dangerous psychopaths is to be believed, we could all do with a bit of a wake-up call. Charm and focus. Jamie's solution to Don and Fran's tenant problem unquestionably carries undertones of ruthlessness. Yet, as Danny's initial qualification of the dilemma quite clearly demonstrates, I'm presuming we're not talking violence here, right? Such ruthlessness need not be conspicuous. The more ingenious its deployment, the more creative the ruthlessness narrative, the greater your chance of pulling it off with impunity. The dagger of hard-nosed self-interest may be concealed, rather deftly, under a benevolent cloak of opaque, obfuscatory charm. The psychopath's capacity for charm is, needless to say, well-documented, as is their ability to focus and get the job done. It goes without saying that it's a powerful and smart combination, and one that all of us could benefit from using. Leslie has joined us and has a rather nice take on charm, the ability to roll out a red carpet for those you cannot stand in order to fast-track them as smoothly and efficiently as possible in the direction you want them to go. With his immaculately coiffured blonde locks and his impeccable cut-glass accent, he looks and sounds like an authority. "People are as nice as you make them," he enunciates, which of course gives you a heck of a lot of power over them. He also has a good take on focus, especially when it comes to getting what you want. Leslie realized from a rather young age that what went on in his head obeyed a different set of operating principles compared with most, and he used that knowledge to his own inexorable advantage. "When I was a kid at school, I tended to avoid fisticuffs," he tells me, "same as I do as an adult. Rather like Jamie, I suppose." Jamie smiles, with more than a hint of wry self-approbation. "You see, I figured out pretty early on that actually the reason why people don't get their own way is because they often don't know themselves where that way leads. They get too caught up in the heat of the moment and temporarily go off track. At that point, the dynamic changes. That's when things become not just about getting what you want, but about being seen to get what you want, about winning." Jamie was talking about boxing there a minute ago. Well, I once heard a great quote from one of the top trainers. He said that if you climb into the ring hell-bent on knocking the other chap into the middle of next week, chances are you're going to come unstuck. But if, on the other hand, you concentrate on winning the fight, simply focus on doing your job, well, you might just knock him into the middle of next week anyway. Leslie's words make perfect sense to me and remind me of an encounter that took place several years ago, one in which vengeance and violence might easily have come into the equation, but charm and focus won the day instead. At 6'5" and 250 pounds, Di Griffiths was built more along the lines of a Greek restaurant than a Greek god. With 23 years unbroken service in a certain British police force, and a score on the PPI that probably placed him further along the psychopathic spectrum than most of the guys he arrested, he'd pretty much seen it all. 20% of the people who come through those doors, he told me, gesturing to the entrance of the detention area, take up 80% of our time. By which, of course, minus the fancy numerics, he meant that recidivists were a pain in the ass. Recidivists, for example, like Ian Cracknell. Cracknell was what you might call a career drunk. Regular as clockwork on a Friday or Saturday night, he'd be brought into the station with a golden future behind him. A bottle of Jack Daniels, usually, and God knows how many beers. What happened then was a routine so well choreographed, it made Swan Lake look like a hoedown. First, Cracknell started to act crazy. Next, a psychiatrist would be called in, as is required by law, to provide an assessment of his mental state. But by the time the shrink arrived, Cracknell, surprise, surprise, was back to normal. Drunk, for sure, but certainly not crazy. The psychiatrist would leave, mumbling something about police incompetence and uncivilized hours, and Cracknell, roaring with laughter, would be bundled into a cell to sleep it off. And then the same thing would happen the next time. The problem with Cracknell seemed irresolvable. How to put an end to his interminable mind games? The trouble, as is the case with most repeat offenders, was that he knew the system pretty much as well as anybody. And, of course, how to play it. Which meant you were left with a choice. You either didn't arrest him at all, or, if you did, you faced the consequences. Usually a blast from some seriously pissed-off psychiatrist. And that, it appeared, was that. Until one night, Griffiths has an idea. Having settled Cracknell into his customary weekend chambers and sent, as usual, for the duty psychiatrist, he makes his way along to the lost property locker. A short time later, shuffling down the corridor in full clown's regalia, Hair, rouge, nose, bells. He drops in on Cracknell again. What, Griffiths inquires, would he like for his breakfast in the morning? Cracknell, to say the least, is incredulous. Sometimes, if he's lucky, he gets a glass of water. Not even a glass, a polystyrene cup. Now, here, he is getting the red carpet treatment. He can't believe his luck. And how would you like your eggs? Griffiths continues. Scrambled, poached, fried, or boiled. With the attention to detail of a top maitre d', he makes a note of everything Cracknell asks for, even the freshly squeezed orange juice. Then he leaves. 10 minutes later, when he returns with the duty psychiatrist, he's back in uniform. So, mutters the psychiatrist, what seems to be the problem this time? Cracknell looks edgy. It's not me you should be talking to, he stammers. It's him. You're not going to believe this, but just before you got here, he was all done up in a clown's costume and asking me what I wanted for breakfast. The psychiatrist shoots Griffiths a suspicious glance. Griffiths just shrugs. Looks like we're in business, he says. Di Griffiths, take my word for it, isn't a man you want to get on the wrong side of in a hurry. Plenty of people have, and most of them ended up with a couple less teeth than they started with. He's not called the dentist for nothing. But Griffiths, quite clearly, has more than one string to his bow. He could easily have taught Cracknell a lesson. Drunks, as everyone knows, have accidents, bang into things, pick up the odd bruise here and there. And yet, he didn't. Instead, he went a different route entirely. He avoided the trap that Leslie had so eloquently warned of, the temptation to not just get what you want, but to be seen to get what you want, to show Cracknell who was boss behind closed doors on a personal, superfluous level, and focused, in contrast, on finding a solution that would resolve the dilemma once and for all, not just for himself, but for his colleagues down the line. He concentrated on the issue at hand, rolled out the red carpet, and eradicated the problem at source. Psychiatrists could put their feet up over the weekend. Of course, the observation that charm, focus, and ruthlessness, three of the psychopath's most instantly recognizable calling cards, constitute, if you can juggle them, a blueprint for successful problem solving, might not come as too great a surprise, perhaps. But that this triumvirate can also predispose, if the gods are really smiling on you, to inordinate, towering, long-term life success might well be a different matter. Take Steve Jobs. Jobs, commented the journalist John Arledge shortly after his death, achieved his cult leader status not just by being single-minded, driven, focused. He exuded, according to one former colleague, a blast furnace intensity, perfectionistic, uncompromising, and a total ball breaker. All successful business leaders are like that, however much their highly paid PR honeys might try to tell us they are laid-back fellas, just like the rest of us. No, there was more to him than that. In addition, Arledge notes, he had charisma, he had vision. He would, as the technology writer Walt Mossberg revealed, even at private viewings, drape a cloth over a product, some pristine new creation on a shiny boardroom table, and uncover it with a flourish. Apple isn't the world's greatest techno-innovator, nowhere near it, in fact. Rather, it excels, in contrast, at rehashing other people's ideas. It wasn't the first outfit to introduce a personal computer, IBM. Nor was it the first to introduce a smartphone, Nokia. Indeed, when it has gone down the innovation road, it's often screwed up. Anyone remember the Newton or the Power Mac G4 Cube? But what Jobs did bring to the table was style, sophistication, and timeless technological charm. He rolled out the red carpet for consumers, from living rooms, offices, design studios, film sets, you name it, right to the doors of Apple stores the world over. Mental toughness. Apple's setbacks along the road to world domination, indeed, they were on the verge of going down the drain in the early days, serve as a cogent reminder of the pitfalls and stumbling blocks that await all of us in life. No one has it all their own way. Everyone, at some point or other, leaves someone on the ground, as the Leonard Cohen song goes. And there's a pretty good chance that someone today, tomorrow, or at some other auspicious juncture down the line is going to turn out to be you. Psychopaths, lest Jamie and the boys have yet to disabuse you, have no problem whatsoever facilitating others' relationships with the floor. But they're also pretty handy when they find themselves on the receiving end, when fate takes a swing and they're the ones in the firing line. And such inner neural steel, such inestimable indifference in the face of life's misfortunes is something that we could all, in one way or another, do with a little bit more of. James Rilling, associate professor of anthropology at Emory University, has demonstrated this in the lab and has discovered in an iterated prisoner's dilemma task like the one we discussed in Chapter 3, an odd yet uplifting paradox about the psychopath. Perhaps not surprisingly, psychopaths exhibit an enhanced propensity for defection under such conditions, which in turn precipitates elevated levels of belligerence, of opportunistic interpersonal aggression, encapsulated in the cooperate-defect dynamic, on the part of their opposite numbers. Yet here's the deal. When the shoe's on the other foot, they simply aren't as bothered by such setbacks. Following the occurrence of these turnaround, see-how-you-like-it outcomes, in which those scoring high in psychopathy find their own attempts to cooperate unreciprocated, Rilling and his co-workers uncovered something interesting in their brains. Compared with their nicer, more equitable fellow participants, the psychopaths exhibit significantly reduced activity in their amygdala, a registered neural trademark of turning the other cheek, which can sometimes manifest itself in rather unusual ways. When we were kids, Jamie chimes in, we'd have a competition, see who could get shot down the most times on a night out, you know, by girls like. Although in old McAllister's case here, we'd have had to have widened the field a bit. Larry looks at me nonplussed. Anyway, the bloke who'd got the most by the time the lights came on would get the next night out for free. Of course, it was in your interest to rack up as many as possible, weren't it? A night on the town with everything taken care of by your mates? Aces. But the funny thing was, soon as you started to get a few under your belt, it actually got fucking harder. Soon as you realize that it actually means jack shit, you start getting cocky. You start mouthing off, and some of the birds start to buy it. Give rejection the finger, and rejection gives it back. Fearlessness. Jamie and company aren't the first to make the connection between fearlessness and mental toughness. Lee Krust and Richard Keegan of the University of Lincoln, for example, have shown that the majority of life's risk-takers tend to score higher on tests of general mental toughness than those who are risk-averse, with scores on the challenge-slash-openness-to-experience subscale being the single biggest predictor of physical risk-taking, and scores on the confidence subscale being the biggest predictor of psychological risk-taking. Both qualities that psychopaths have in abundance. Recall the words of Andy McNabb in the previous chapter? You know there's a high chance of getting killed on a mission. You know there's a fair probability of being captured by enemy troops. You know there's a good possibility that you and your parachute will be swallowed up by waves the size of high-rises in some seething foreign ocean. But fuck it. You get on with it. That's what Special Forces soldiering is all about. That members of Special Forces are both fearless and mentally tough, psychopathically so, it emerges, as the results of many of those I've tested bear witness, is beyond doubt. In fact, the instructors in the SAS's brutal, bestial selection process, which extends over a period of 9 months and which only a handful of candidates pass, are specifically on the lookout for such qualities, as some of the nightmares one endures in it attest to. One example, recounted to me by a guy who came out on top, provides a pretty good insight into the kind of mental toughness that separates the men from the boys, that exemplifies the mindset, the elite psychological makeup of those who eventually prevail. It's not the violence that breaks you, he elucidates. It's the threat of violence, that carcinogenic thought process that something terrible is going to happen and that it's just around the corner. He goes into details about one particular instance, which put me off fixing my car exhaust forever. Typically, by this stage, the candidate's exhausted. Then the last thing he sees before we place the hood over his head is the 2-ton truck. We lie him down on the ground, and as he lies there, he hears the sound of the truck getting closer. After 30 seconds or so, it's right on top of him. The engine just inches away from his ear. We give it a good rev, and then the driver jumps out. He slams the door and walks away. The engine's still running. A little while later, from somewhere in the distance, someone asks if the handbrake's on. At this point, one of the team, who, unbeknownst to the guy in the hood, has been there all the time, gently starts to roll a spare tire onto his temple as he lies on the ground. You know, by hand. Gradually, he increases the pressure. Another member of the team revs the truck up a bit, so it seems like it might be moving. After a few seconds of that, we take the tire away and remove the hood. Then we lay into him. It's not unusual for people to throw in the towel at that point. I amuse the fellas, Danny, Larry, Jamie, and Leslie, with my own little taste of SAS selection, which I got while doing a TV pilot. Chained to the floor of a cold, dimly lit warehouse, I watched, in abject terror, as a forklift truck dangled a pallet of reinforced concrete several yards above my head, and then proceeded to lower it so that the sharp, rough-hewn base exerted a gentle pressure on my chest. It remained there for about 15 seconds before I heard the operator yell above the scream of the hydraulics, "Shit, the mechanism's jammed, I can't lift it!" In hindsight, in the safety of the debriefing room, it soon became clear that I'd been in no physical danger whatsoever. In actual fact, the reinforced concrete hadn't been concrete at all. It was painted polystyrene. But of course, I hadn't known that at the time, and neither do the special forces candidates who undergo such ordeals in selection. It had all been horribly real. Jamie, however, is distinctly unimpressed. "But even if the mechanism had jammed," he points out, "that doesn't mean to say the rig's going to come crashing down on top of you, does it? It just means you're stuck there for a while. So what? You know, I've thought about this. They say that courage is a virtue, right? But what if you don't need courage? What then? What if you don't have fear to start with? If you don't have fear to start with, you don't need courage to overcome it, do you? The concrete and tire stunts wouldn't have bothered me, mate. They're just mind games. But that doesn't make me brave. If I couldn't give a shit in the first place, how can it? So you see, I just don't buy it. It seems to me that the reason you harp on about courage all the time, the reason people feel they need it, is to bring yourself up to the level I function at naturally. You may call it a virtue, but in my book, it's natural talent. Courage is just emotional blood doping. Mindfulness. Sitting on a sofa opposite a 6'2" psychopathic skinhead as he positions a sizable psychological magnet by the side of your moral compass isn't exactly comfortable. I'm well aware of psychopaths' considerable powers of persuasion, but even so, I can't help thinking that Jamie has a point. What a hero might do against the muffled synaptic screaming of hardwired survival instincts, a psychopath might do in silence, without even breaking a sweat. And to set the compass spinning even faster, Leslie introduces another existential conundrum to the proceedings. "But it's not just about functionality, though, is it?" he demurs. "The thing about fear, or the way I understand fear, I suppose, because to be honest, I don't think I've ever really felt it, is that most of the time it's completely unwarranted anyway. What is it they say? 99% of the things people worry about never happen? So what's the point?" I think the problem is that people spend too much time worrying about what might happen, what might go wrong, that they completely lose sight of the present. They completely overlook the fact that, actually, right now, everything's perfectly fine. You can see that quite clearly in your interrogation exercise. What was it that chap told you? It's not the violence that breaks you, it's the threat of it. So why not just stay in the moment? I mean, think about it. Like Jamie says, while you were lying under the lump of concrete, or rather what you thought was concrete, nothing bad was really happening to you, was it? Okay, a four-poster might have been more relaxing, but actually, if you'd been asleep, you'd really have been none the wiser, would you? Instead, what freaked you out was your imagination. Your brain was on fast-forward mode, whizzing and whirring through all the possible disasters that might unfold, but didn't. So the trick, whenever possible, I propose, is to stop your brain from running on ahead of you. Keep doing that, and sooner or later, you'll kick the courage habit too. Or you can always use your imagination to your advantage, interjects Danny. Next time you're in a situation where you're scared, just think, imagine I didn't feel this way. What would I do then? And then just do it anyway. Good advice, if you've got the balls to take it. Listening to Jamie, Leslie, and Danny, you might well be forgiven for thinking you were in the presence of greatness, of three old Buddhists well on their way down the Eightfold Path to Nirvana. Of course, they're anything but. Yet anchoring your thoughts unswervingly in the present, focusing exclusively, immediately on the here and now, is a cognitive discipline that psychopathy and spiritual enlightenment have in common. Mark Williams, professor of clinical psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Oxford, incorporates this principle of centering in his mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, program for sufferers of anxiety and depression. Mindfulness, I tease Mark, in his office at the Warrenford Hospital, is basically Buddhism with a polished wooden floor, isn't it? He offers me a sweet roll. You forget the spotlights and the plasma TV, he counters. But yes, there is a certain whiff of the East in a lot of the theory and practice. Mark gives me an example of how mindfulness-based CBT might help someone overcome a phobia, like a fear of flying, for instance. Jamie, Leslie, and Danny couldn't have put it better. One approach, Mark explains, might be to take the person on a plane and seat them next to a flying buff. You know, someone who absolutely loves being up in the air. Then, mid-flight, you hand them a pair of brain scans. One of them depicts a happy brain. The other one depicts an anxious brain, a brain in a state of terror. This pair of pictures, you tell them, represents exactly what's going on in each of your heads right now, at this precise moment in time. So obviously, because they're so different, neither of them really means anything, do they? Neither of them predicts the physical state of the plane. That truth is in the engines. So what do they signify, you ask them? Well, you explain, what in fact they do represent is precisely what you're holding in your hands, a brain state, nothing more, nothing less. What you're feeling is simply just that, a feeling, a neural network, an electrical ensemble, a chemical configuration caused by thoughts in your head that drift in and out, that come and go, like clouds. Now, if you can bring yourself round to somehow accepting that fact, to dispassionately observe your inner virtual reality, to let the clouds float by, to let their shadows fall and linger where they please, and focus instead on what's going on around you, each pixelated second of each ambient sound and sensation, then eventually, over time, your condition should begin to improve. Action. Jamie and the boys' pragmatic endorsement of the principles and practices of mindfulness, though not necessarily of the precise existential variety that a distinguished Oxford professor might extol, is typical of the psychopath. Their rapacious proclivity to live in the moment, to give tomorrow the slip and take today on a joyride, as Larry rather whimsically puts it, is well documented, and at times, therapeutic implications aside, can be stupendously beneficial. Take the financial world, for instance. Don Novick was a trader for 16 years and didn't lose a penny in any of them. He is also, as it happens, a psychopath. These days, retired, though still only 46, he lives quietly in the Scottish Highlands, adding to his wine cellar and collecting vintage watches. I call Don a psychopath because that's what he calls himself. At least, he did the first time I met him. So, to be on the safe side, I decided to run a few tests. The results turned out to be positive. Sitting in one of the drawing rooms of his secluded Jacobean castle, the driveway so long it could do with a couple of service stations, I asked Don, quite literally, the million-dollar question. What precisely is it that makes a successful trader? I'm not too interested in the difference between good and bad, I point out. More in the difference between good and really good. Though he doesn't name names, he has no hesitation in answering the question objectively from a qualitative, analytical standpoint. I would say that one of the biggest differences when it comes to separating out the really good traders is how they seem at close of day, when trading is finished and they're turning it in for the day, he tells me. You know, trading is a profession that, if you're the least bit vulnerable mentally, can completely undo you. I've seen traders crying and being physically sick at the end of a hard session. The pressure, the environment, the people, it's all pretty brutal. But what you find with the guys at the very top is that at the end of the day, when they're heading out the door, you just don't know. You can't tell by looking at them whether they've raked in a couple of billion or whether their entire portfolio has just gone down the tubes. And there it is in a nutshell. Therein lies the fundamental principle of being a good trader. When you're trading, you cannot allow any members of your brain's emotional executive committee to knock on the door of the decision-making boardroom, let alone take a seat at the table. Ruthlessly, remorselessly, relentlessly, you have to stay in the present. You can't let what happened yesterday affect what happens today. If you do, you'll go under in no time. If you're prone to emotional hangovers, you're not going to last 2 seconds on the trading floor. Don's observations, coming as they do from 16 years of trading on the fiscal razor's edge, are strongly reminiscent of the lab-based results from Baba Shiv, Antoine Bechara, and George Lowenstein's gambling game study. Logically, of course, the right thing to do was to invest in every round. But as the game panned out, some of the participants began declining the opportunity to gamble, preferring instead to conserve their winnings. They began, in other words, to live in the past, allowing, in Don's words, members of their brain's emotional executive committee to knock on the door of the decision-making boardroom. Bad move. But other participants continued to live in the present, and at the conclusion of the study, they boasted a pretty healthy profit margin. These functional psychopaths, as Antoine Bechara referred to them, individuals who are either better at regulating their emotions than others or, alternatively, don't experience them to the same degree of intensity, continued to invest and treated each new round as if it were the first. Oddly enough, they went from strength to strength, and exactly as Don would have predicted, indeed did predict when I told him about the experiment, wiped the floor with their cagier, more risk-averse rivals. But the story doesn't end there. Several years ago, when news of this study first hit the popular press, it carried a headline that grabbed a few headlines itself. Wanted, psychopaths to make a killing in the market. According to Don, the caption has hidden depths. A professional killer, like an executioner, for instance, probably has no feeling at all after taking someone's life, he explains. Plausibly, remorse or regret just don't come into the equation. It's a similar story with traders. When a trader completes a trade, he'll call it an execution. That's common trading parlance. And once a trade has been executed, the really good traders, the kind of guys that you're interested in, will have no compunction at all about getting out, about the whys and wherefores, the pros and cons, about whether it's right or wrong. And that's completely irrespective, going back to what I was saying earlier, of how that trade has gone, whether they've made a couple of billion or whether they've thrown it down the toilet. Exiting a trade will be a cool and clinical decision that has no subsequent emotion, no lingering psychological after effects attached to it whatsoever. I think the idea of killing professionally, be it in the market or elsewhere, demands a certain ability to compartmentalize, to focus on the job at hand, and when that job is finished, to just walk away and forget it ever happened. Of course, living in the past is just one side of the equation. Living in the future, getting ahead of ourselves, allowing our imagination to run riot, as mine had under the pallet of reinforced concrete, or whatever the hell it was, can be equally incapacitating. Studies, for instance, of cognitive and emotional focus in the context of dysfunctional decision-making have shown that when we evaluate common everyday behaviors, things like diving into a swimming pool or picking up the phone and delivering bad news, the imagined potential reality is significantly more discomforting than the real one. Which explains, of course, our unquenchable urge to procrastinate much of the time. But psychopaths never procrastinate. Just one of the reasons why, if you recall the words of Richard Blake from earlier, my host at Broadmoor and one of the clinical team in the Paddock Center, they tend to excel at activities on the ward. Psychopaths need to do something. Nothing just isn't an option. "Feeling good is an emergency for me," Danny had commented, as he'd slammed in his fourth goal for Chelsea. "I like to ride the roller coaster of life, spin the roulette wheel of fortune to terminal possibility." He frowned and adjusted his baseball cap. "Or at least I did," he shrugged, "till I got in here." Coming from a psychopath, it's not an untypical statement, one we could all perhaps do with taking on board just that little bit more in our lives. "When I was a kid," Larry tells me, "we used to go on holiday every year to Hastings. One day, I'll never forget it, I watched my sister playing in the sea, and this big wave came in and hit her. She ran out crying, and that was that. She never went in again. When I saw what had happened, and I couldn't have been more than 7 or 8 at the time, I remember thinking to myself, if you stand where the waves break, you're going to get hurt. So you've got 2 choices. You can either stay on the shore and not go in at all, or you can go out further so the waves lift you up and then crash and break behind you." Jamie gets to his feet. "The secret, of course, is not to go out too far," he grunts. "Otherwise, you wash up in this place." SOS mentality. "Well, you know where I am. I ain't going nowhere." Jamie and I are shaking hands. I've just told him I'll definitely look him up next time I'm passing, and he's filled me in on his movements. Larry and Leslie have already bowed out, Leslie quite literally, with a sweeping genuflection, Larry with a sturdy salute. Maybe the old boy was a former sea captain after all. Danny's returned to the football. Back in the corridors and security-infested wormholes that connect the DSPD unit with the outside world, I feel a bit like a spaceman on re-entry. "Settle in okay?" Richard inquires as we jangle our way back to clinical psychology suburbia. I smile. Started to feel quite at home. As the train picks up speed for London, I study the expressions of those sitting around me, commuters mostly, on their way home from work. Some are tense and anxious, others are tired and drawn. You don't see many of those kinds of faces at psychopath school. I fire up the laptop and punch in some thoughts. An hour or so later, as we pull into the station, I had the template for what I term an SOS mentality. The psychological skill set to strive, overcome, and succeed. I call this skill set the 7 deadly wins, 7 core principles of psychopathy that, apportioned judiciously and applied with due care and attention, can help us get exactly what we want, can help us respond rather than react to the challenges of modern-day living, can transform our outlook from victim to victor, but without turning us into a villain. 1. Ruthlessness. 2. Charm. 3. Focus. 4. Mental toughness. 5. Fearlessness. 6. Mindfulness. 7. Action. Without a shadow of a doubt, the power of the skill set lay squarely in its application. Certain situations would inevitably call for more of some traits than others, while within those, some sub-situations, going back to the mixing desk analogy, would plausibly demand higher or lower output levels of whichever traits were selected. Cranking up the ruthlessness, mental toughness, and action dials, for instance, might make you more assertive, might earn you more respect among your work colleagues. But ratchet them up too high, and you risk morphing into a tyrant. Then, of course, there was the opposite consideration of being able to turn them back down, of fading in and out and appropriately contouring the soundtrack. If the lawyer, for example, who we met in Chapter 4, was as ruthless and fearless in everyday life as he evidently was in the courtroom, he would have soon ended up needing a lawyer of his own. The secret, unquestionably, was context. It wasn't about being a psychopath. It was rather about being a method psychopath, about being able to step into character when the situation demanded it, but then, when the exigency had passed, to revert to one's normal persona. That, of course, was where Jamie and the boys had gone wrong. Rather than having trouble twiddling the faders up higher, theirs, in contrast, were permanently stuck on max. A manufacturing error with decidedly unfortunate consequences. As Jamie articulated when I'd first arrived in Broadmoor, the problem with psychopaths isn't that they're chock full of evil. Ironically, it's precisely the opposite. They have too much of a good thing. The car is to die for. It's just too fast for the road.
Context of white supremacy. The secret, unquestionably, was context. Pops up all the time. So that is the end of Chapter 6. When we pick back up, we'll be on Chapter 7. We pick back up for the next audio segment. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61. If you would like to participate, if you want to join in, but you're not able to use your phone or don't want to, you can use the free VOPE line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.cc/oneRace, and that is the number one. Address again, tiny. tiny.cc/oneRace, and that is the number one. When you enter that address, click the link on the left of the page. It'll say free VOPE line. When you click that link, it will open a small window on your screen. The first line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for a code. That code again, 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name. You can press random keys. You can put in a nickname, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. It is the same procedure if you're interested in speaking. You'll see a dial pad on your screen. Press *61. I'll see your hand, and we will get you on the line. That's it. I know it's been such a long interval, and folks were able to follow and keep up. I hate reading a book and then having a long delay, because a lot of times you don't even, you know, go back to finish reading it. If you put it down for a month, it's hard to remember where you were and everything in the book. But be that as it may, sticking to it, persevering. Folks have commentary on the first chunk of the reading. Folks who have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. This is Red in Nevada. A couple of the notes that I have. I guess the most important thing that I heard and I remember reading, I don't have the book anymore, but it was just, the audio was just recently said, basically how you're supposed to be like a method psychopath. So you're supposed to turn it on and turn it off when the situation calls for it. And I definitely feel like it definitely helps me to better understand how, you know, it's basically like how white people, they can multitask. They know, you know, when a racist, they can multitask, you know, when they know when to turn on their psychopathy and when to turn it off. Sometimes when it comes to especially being around non-white black people, they put on this, you know, that's when they put on the charm, one of those, as he quoted, the seven winds, or not the seven deadly winds or something like that. So I definitely thought that was really important to me. The other thing is that I noticed how he liked to quote and talk about the person Jamie a lot, and he described him in the physical book, it was on page 178. He described him as a skinhead, and I kind of feel like maybe, you know, I think of, like, you know, in the American sense, you know, skinhead, Ku Klux Klan, you know, that type of person. But I thought that was kind of interesting how he kind of gravitated more towards him, and how even on page 85, how he was like, he even told him, or it could have been a lie, of course, but how, you know, he wanted to see him again, or he might, you know, decide to look him up or whatever. I like the part, I think it was on page 184, where he talked about, I can't remember if it was, I think he might have been quoting someone else, I guess the retired trader, that, you know, once the job is finished, you walk away and you forget about it, basically. So that kind of goes into that whole ruthlessness. So you don't care about how these people feel. So it's kind of like, why are we forgiving people who don't care? They do what they want to do to, you know, uphold the system, and they don't think twice about it. And it seems like that's been coming up. Has come up before in the book when he spoke to the Andy McNabb person, who basically quoted that same thing when it was referred to, you know, if you're in a hostile situation, you pull the trigger and then you forget about it. You don't worry about, you don't keep, basically keep harping on it. The last thing that I'll mention is when he talked about the nonchalantness, or being nonchalant, psychopath being nonchalant, and how that shouldn't be looked at as being courageous. And I definitely appreciate that. And it just makes me kind of think that we shouldn't, like, our victims of white supremacy, we shouldn't necessarily be congratulating or thanking white people for, you know, having some possible truths, telling us some possible truths about the system of racism, white supremacy. It's not like they've really done anything major. There's no reason to, you know, be so grateful for that. And I'll mute my line at that. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Red in Nevada. Excellent in terms of not thanking white folks for giving up a few tidbits about racism, white supremacy. I think I've seen a lot of that happen down through the years, where we are ready to give out congratulations, and that is not in order at all. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have a commentary on the first portion of the book, that was all of chapter 6 that we just heard. If you have a hand up, line should be open.
proceed. Assume some of the folks who have a hand up, they might be in a noisy area or taking a bit of their own time. I will look back and share some of my own notes to give folks a bit of time to get themselves together. See, going back to the very beginning of the chapter, when he's going to this detention facility and he checks in his trusty Glock 17 pistol, I'm not sure how many other authors, the numerous books that we've covered over the years, I'm not sure how many of the authors admit within the text to what type of firearm they're toting as they go out to conduct their interviews and speak with subjects for their book. That stood out for me, gun-toting whites. I think I put that in the description for the compensatory call-in, gun-toting whites, from Dylan Roof all the way across the pond to Kevin Dutton. The next one, when he gives the inventory for the careers. Now, this is just for Britain, where they're going to do this assessment of different professions, where they got folks to take the Great British Psychopath survey. And so then they give the 10 professions that have the highest levels of psychopathy, and then they give, then they give the 10 professions with the lowest levels of psychopathy. And of the 10 professions with the lowest levels, number 7 was teacher, number 9 was doctor, and I highlighted both of those. I find that hard to believe. I'm a little suspicious of that. And again, now this is for Britain. Now, if you're a teacher in Britain, presumably you would have a significantly higher number of white students, I would think, than you would in the States. You certainly wouldn't have as many black students in Britain as you would in the States. Presumably that would be the case if you're a doctor for patients you would be treating as well. You would have a lower number of patients. But I just think of medical apartheid and what they call the school-to-prison pipeline. I do not think in the U.S. that you have low levels of psychopathy amongst white teachers, white doctors, stateside, even in the world. Moving forward, let's see, when they start talking about this facility and where they're making distinctions and saying that, you know, about 20% of the patients housed here are pure, in quotes, psychopaths, and they have them, you know, confined to this certain area. That reminded me of Mr. Fuller when he talks about racists going to the bottom of the ocean and studying a grain of sand in order to refine their system in terms of that level of detail, where we've studied our population, we've studied the inmates, and we have divided them up into these different types of groups based on how dangerous they are, their levels of criminality. We've divided them up so we can better manage them. And they do that same sort of thing with victims of white supremacy, in my opinion. I could be in error. When he starts talking about some of these characters that he's speaking with, inmates, presumably, in this detention facility, where he describes the first, he says, or he's just describing the facility at first. He says, the vibe on the ward isn't what I'm expecting. My first impression of an extremely well-appointed college dormitory, all blonde, clean-shaven wood. I thought that was interesting for a couple of points. Number one, just to contrast that with the types of prison environments that Khalif Browders of the world are subjected to here in the U.S. and other places where you have a high population of black people that are going to be caged. I don't think that they get prison environments that look like college dormitories with blonde, clean-shaven wood. And I just thought, again, the association with blonde generally being associated with the hair of individuals classified as white or often being associated with them, that being associated with having premium, high-quality furniture and housing for these inmates. That stood out. And then, Wellsing moment, of course, they got a pool table too, all the luxuries. Let's see, next. When they start going through these different scenarios, and I feel like he's done that a few times in the book. He's talking to Jamie here. I think Red Nevada said that's one of the favorite skinhead type characters that get described. And when Jamie, I think his suggestion of what to do if you had to get rid of a tenant who didn't want to move, and his suggestion was, you know, to make up this ruse about asbestos, and the asbestos investigator comes by and tricks them, and then the person will want to leave on their own. And the phrase is, sometimes in life, it's a case of the least worst option. I feel like whites give those types of sentences on a regular basis to justify doing something that many might deem to be incorrect. They will, you know, say that's the case. I would say that because in this situation, what he's proposing is lying. Anytime that you're lying to harm someone that's going to be to their detriment, that is mistreatment. I'm sure they have other options to deal with a situation like that, as opposed to lying to someone where it's going to be to their detriment. And he's not even just talking about lying. He even, I think one of the other things that he proposed, Jamie proposed, was to just change the locks on them, and then to sell off their stuff. And I feel like the mistreatment aspect, when he's talking about the wisdom of psychopaths, and we could learn a lot from them and the way that they go about making decisions and just being very utilitarian about things, getting things done and being fearless, being courageous. I feel like the mistreatment aspect of how they operate, I feel like that gets minimized frequently in the text. I feel like I've said that for a long time. We've been on this book so long with a delay, but I feel like I was saying that a lot, reading that a lot in the first portion before the delay, and that continues, minimizing the mistreatment aspect of what's happening with these psychopaths, that a key aspect of how they function and how they are so successful, put that in quotes, is a willingness to mistreat other people. And that is the system of racism, white supremacy, constant, eternal willingness to mistreat, particularly black people, non-white people. Next up, speaking of blonde, when they start talking about charm, which again, all of this charm that they're talking about with psychopaths is charm for mistreatment. Jeffrey Dahmer, charming for mistreatment. When they bring that up in this chapter here, where he's describing Leslie, another one of the inmates, he says, with his immaculately coiffured blonde locks, again, all the esteem, prestige, and accolades to blondness, whether it's describing the blonde wood or blonde hair of the inmates, psychopaths, and his impeccable cut glass accent, he looks and sounds like an authority. And even in my opinion, blondness, whiteness being associated with authority, even an inmate. People are as nice as you make them, he enunciates, which of course gives you a heck of a lot of power over them. I think Red talked about this. I think racists are extraordinary at this. I think we talked about this on the program before. Racists have the ability to be nice to black people, and that confuses a lot of us, where this person is still racist. They have just paused from calling you a nigger for the for maybe 5 minutes or 30 minutes, maybe a day or so, long enough for them to carry out whatever their objective is while they're being nice to you. And I mean, sometimes it could be, hey, they could be nice to you for a year. They could be nice to you for 2 years, whatever their objective is and what they're trying to get done. They are great with this. And again, this is about mistreatment. In my view, I think this gets presented as, hey, this is something great that we could pick up on, and they're so charming and they're so nice, and look at Steve Jobs and doing this. All of this at the end of the day is about mistreatment. How can I coerce you? How can I control you? How can I manipulate you? And if I can be nice to you, then I can manipulate you to my ends. I think that that gets greatly minimized in the way that this is presented in the text. I will pause there. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, again, number 641-715-3640, code 564-943 pound. Press star 6-1 if you have commentary. Retired firefighter, did you have commentary you wanted to share? Or are you just listening, sir?
Greetings. I was kind of listening to try to, you know, gather my thoughts. You or anybody can help me out with this. This book primarily is based on the writer giving his observations about white people who are quote unquote psychopaths, or just white people in general and their mental issues.
That's pretty close, yeah. Like an assessment, I guess, of what his view of what psychopathy is, and how studying psychopaths, and pretty much everyone he's listed in the book, psychopath or no, has been white, I think, unless I've been in error, and how studying them and some of the attributes that make them unique, how some of those attributes can be used for quote unquote success for everyone, the rest of us who are not psychopaths, presumably.
Oh, so perhaps if he is kind of like encouraging people to develop some psychopathic abilities.
That is certainly one way you could articulate it. You know, I think he would say that's not quite it. I think he would probably say, and I think he's maybe said in the book in interviews, that it's more of looking at some of the characteristics of psychopaths that could be applied in moderation. I think that was a big metaphor analogy. He was talking about the mixing dial and maybe not having it turned up too much in terms of the attributes that he lists: ruthlessness, charm, focus, mental toughness, fearlessness, mindfulness, being courageous, taking some of these attributes and using them, just not all the time or not too much. I think he emphasized that a few times in the chapter.
Okay, last but not least, through my studies, white people are experts at a lot of things. Is this white person, does he have some sort of expertise on the subject?
This is listed on his faculty page. He's a professor at the University of Oxford. They're one of the most prestigious universities, according to many whites, on the planet. He's a professor there, and this is one of his areas of study, psychology and psychopathy specifically. I think he's looked at as being an expert in that field, the study of psychopathy.
Good. Okay. Well, the ignorant retired firefighter is going to pay attention. All right. Thank you.
Yes, sir, for sure. Other folks have commentary, feel free. We only have one chapter left. Now, the seventh chapter is a little longer, so I don't think we'll finish the entire seventh chapter today. I think that'll all be next week. We should have one more session to wrap up the rest of the book. I'm checking the page number really quick just to make sure. Yeah, I think we should have one more session, and then we should be done next week, moving on to another book. I can get that in really quick. If folks have suggestions, thoughts for the next book, you can drop an email or message or what have you, and let me know if you have thoughts for the next book. We would not be starting it next week. It would be down the road a little bit. But I did have some thoughts, ideas. I was even thinking LaRon Bennett Jr., Forced Into Glory, but that's a longer book and a history. I don't know how excited people would be about reading a history book, but that LaRon Bennett Jr. has written many outstanding texts. He did pass away this week, including Before the Mayflower. Definitely should be an author that you have in your personal library. Also wanted to make sure that I got in my view, I do think some of these attributes can be applied. Some of this to me is just following logic. Like when he talks about making decisions, and particularly the portion where he talks about mindfulness, when you're in a stressful situation and you've got to make a decision, you've got, you know, whatever is happening, it could be on the job or whatever the situation happens to be, being mindful and being alert to the fact that, yes, this is stressful, this is difficult, but I'm going to try and quiet my mind as much as I can so that I can make the best logical decision that will have the best outcome for me. I do see a lot of value in that, as well as some of the other things that he talks about in terms of being charming and finding other ways of solving problems where it's just not going to be direct brute force, that sort of thing. It's just my emphasis on they really minimize the mistreatment aspect of this. that is key with most of what we had heard. It involves direct mistreatment of someone else, whether it's direct violence or them being fooled, manipulated somehow where it is not to their benefit. That not withstanding, a lot of these techniques, I think, can be applied from a counter-racist perspective where victims of racism, we can use some of these attributes to help neutralize, eradicate racism, white supremacy. Give another second or so, see if any caller at 4757. Did you have a commentary you want to share, 4757?
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello?
Yes, Mel, we can hear you. Yes, Mel, we can hear you. Can you hear us? We can hear you, Mel. We can hear you. Not sure what the problem is. It seems you're not able to hear us. If you, I guess if you want to hang up and dial back in, feel free. But we
can. Can I hear now?
We can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yes. Okay. Sorry about that.
Great. Hi, Mel.
Hi there. It's nice to hear you back. So for this session of the reading, the section called mindfulness, there's a section of the text where a day trader, I believe on the stock market, is compared to an executioner. Specifically that, like, after a trade, a trader, like an executioner, has removed emotion from the scenario that they've executed. He said that the trader and the executioner doesn't look back at the past, but instead looks forward to the next trade, so that they're emotionless at the end of the day after either executing or trading. And I just thought that this language and this the inclusion of this example to me suggests a conscious or subconscious link between capitalism and exercises in maintaining gross wealth and murder or death. It reminds me of the kind of the historical link between slavery and the stock exchange, known as Wall Street, which was ruthless and definitely dedicated to white supremacist future and wealth, futures of wealth and stuff. Actually, the idea of him talking about an executioner repeatedly in that section, it just makes me think of like the death facilitator type person, I guess, who they pull that giant switch in the movie for the electric chair. And I am interested on some level as to why he brings up that person who's, I mean, I think an uncommon profession and compares it to a stock trader, which seems like a much more common profession. And I do agree with the point you made about minimizing the mistreatment that psychopaths do on everybody else. I think it's definitely evidenced in this section with how he talks about, I think, the European dude's house having a driveway so long that it needs service stations, or when he calls the important question he has for the trader a million-dollar question. Like, terms like that just seem like they pretty much glamorize the psychopaths that he's talking about at that moment. And that was all I had for right now.
Grand to hear from Mel. Just read the previous book, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, Neil Postman, eons ago now, wasn't that long ago, but great observations as well. If other folks have any commentary, we'll give a minute or two before you're ready to push off into section number two, if folks are lollygagging or waiting to see what will be waiting for us in chapter seven, where we're picking up at. Make sure we didn't miss anyone. Grand. Down the stretch, I guess, since this is chapter seven, if folks can recall, if you have overall observations about the book, overall themes, things that have stood out for the totality of the book. Again, difficult to kind of piece back and remember for so long ago what we were talking about way back in December and even November when we first started the text, but trying as best we can, and for folks who are maybe newer listeners, all of the previous sections are in the archives. So you can access the previous sessions, previous chapters, go back and hear the commentary, and then it'll be seamless. Everything will make sense if you're a newer listener just coming in. I will think anything else that I want to make sure I got in from the chapter. I just, even having a white person having the ability from him traveling, because he's in the UK, but it seems he's done a lot of traveling to different parts of the world. He went to the serial killer museum that was way back in the first chapter. And then he's traveled around and met all these different people, going to talk to these folks at the detention center that we heard about today, and going to meet different researchers who are doing their studies and what have you, to have money to go around and write a book on this particular subject. Just wow. In a system of racism, white supremacy. And I mean, if you want to compare that to Dr. Welsing, also similar field, studying human behavior, struggled mightily. Would she get, you know, funding, research to go around and study racists in the same sort of manner and compile information? I just think it is amazing what white people, the way that white men, white women, white children are allowed to use their time, energy, and even what interests they are allowed to pursue in the system of racism, white supremacy, on display in this here book and other places. With that, if other folks have commentary that you want to share, if you could just make a note, if you have something stood out you didn't get to share, just jot it down. That way you won't forget. We should have ample time to share once the second audio segment concludes. We'll go ahead and get started on Chapter 7 again. I know we're not going to finish it because Chapter 7 is kind of chunky, but we'll at least get a good ways into it, and then I think we'll wrap the whole thing up next week in the book, and we'll be thinking about what we want to read next. But again, this is Mr. Kevin Gutton, Racist Suspect, his book, The Wisdom of Psychopaths, Chapter 7, Context of White Supremacy.
Chapter 7, Super Sanity. Life should not be a journey to the grave with the intention of arriving safely in a pretty and well-preserved body, but rather to skid in broadside in a cloud of smoke, thoroughly used up, totally worn out, and loudly proclaiming, "Wow, what a ride!" Hunter S. Thompson. Generation P. At the back of the chapel of Magdalen College, Oxford, there sits a prayer board. One day, amid the numerous petitions for divine intervention, I noticed this one. "Lord, please make my lottery numbers come up, then you won't ever have to hear from me again." Strangely enough, it was the only one that God had replied to. Here is what he wrote. "My son, I like your style. In this wretched, mixed-up world, which causes me so much sorrow, you've put a smile on my face. Hell, I want to hear from you again. So, better luck next time, you cheeky bastard. Love, God." Anyone who thought that God didn't have a sense of humor might want to think again. And anyone who thought that God was so remote from the world that he didn't take a personal interest in the trifling concerns of his lost little children might also wish to reconsider. Here, quite clearly, the Almighty sees fit to present a different side of himself, as a shrewd, tough, no-nonsense operator, able to give as good as he gets, and with more than a passing knowledge of human psychology. If that sounds like the kind of God who's not afraid to twiddle those dials on the mixing desk up and down when the situation calls for it, then you're not mistaken. In 1972, the writer Alan Harrington published a little-known book called Psychopaths. In it, he advanced a radical new theory of human evolution. Psychopaths, contended Harrington, constitute a dangerous new breed of Homo sapiens, a made-to-measure Darwinian contingency plan for the cold, hard exigencies of modern-day existence, an indomitable Generation P. Key to his thesis was the progressive, insidious weakening, as he saw it, of the primeval ionic bonds, ethical, emotional, existential, that for century upon century, millennium upon millennium, had bound humanity together. Once, argued Harrington, when Western civilization subscribed to hard work and virtue-seeking, the psychopath was confined to the margins of mainstream society. He was condemned by his fellow right-minded citizens as either a madman or an outlaw. But as the 20th century unfolded, and society, over time, became ever more fast and loose, psychopaths came in from the cold. For a Cold War novelist from a non-scientific background, Alan Harrington certainly knew his stuff. His depiction of the psychopath rivals, in fact, occasionally even surpasses, given its diverse, eclectic brushstrokes, many of the portraits one sometimes reads today. The psychopath, as Harrington defines him, is the new man, a psychological superhero free from the shackles of anxiety and remorse. He is brutal, bored, and adventurous, but also, when the situation demands it, beatific. Harrington cites some examples: drunkards and forgers, addicts, flower children, mafia loan shark battering his victim, charming actor, murderer, nomadic guitarist, hustling politician, the saint who lies down in front of tractors, the icily dominating Nobel Prize winner stealing credit from laboratory assistants, all doing their thing, and all without the slightest care in the world. St. Paul, the patron saint of psychopaths. Harrington's inclusion of saints on the list is no accident. It's also no one-off. Throughout his book, the cool, iridescent prose is littered with comparisons between psychopaths and the spiritually enlightened, not all of them his own. He quotes, for instance, the physician Hervey Cleckley, whom we met in Chapter 2, compiler in his 1941 classic The Mask of Sanity, of one of the first clinical descriptions of psychopathy. What he, the psychopath, believes he needs to protest against turns out to be no small group, no particular institution or set of ideologies, but human life itself. In it, he seems to find nothing deeply meaningful or persistently stimulating, but only some transient and relatively petty, pleasant caprices, a terribly repetitious series of minor frustrations and ennui. Like many teenagers, saints, author's emphasis, history-making statesmen, and other notable leaders or geniuses, he shows unrest. He wants to do something about the situation. Harrington also quotes Norman Mailer. The psychopath is an elite with the potential ruthlessness of an elite. His inner experience of the possibilities within death is his logic. So too for the existentialist and the saint and the bullfighter and the lover. The implications are intriguing. Is it possible, Harrington asks, that the saint and the psychopath somehow constitute two transcendental sides of the same existentialist coin? Is it possible, whether we want to admit it or not, for the most wicked, wholly inexcusable psychopath to murder his way into a state of grace? Achieve a sort of purity by terrible means, be transformed by his ordeal and the ordeals he imposed on others into a different person, his spirit cleansed by theater, publicity, fame, terror? Though contrary, perhaps, to their delicate intellectual sensibilities, New Testament scholars might struggle to disagree. 2,000 years ago, a certain Saul of Tarsus sanctioned the deaths of countless numbers of Christians following the public execution of their leader, and could today, under the dictates of the Geneva Convention, have been indicted on charges of genocide. We all know what happened to him. A dazzling conversion as he journeyed on the road to Damascus transformed him, quite literally overnight, from a murderous, remorseless tent maker into one of the most important figures in the history of the Western world. St. Paul, as we know him now, is the author of just over half of the entire New Testament. 14 of the 27 books that comprise the corpus are attributed to him, is the hero of another, the Acts of the Apostles, and is the subject of some of the best stained glass in the business. But he was, in addition, more than likely a psychopath. Ruthless, fearless, driven, and charismatic in equal measure. Let's take a look at the evidence. Paul's apparent predilection, both on the open road and within seething inner cities, for dangerous, inhospitable areas, put him at constant risk of random, violent assault. Add to that the fact that he was shipwrecked a grand total of 3 times during his travels around the Mediterranean basin, on one occasion spending 24 hours adrift in the open sea before being rescued, and a picture begins to emerge of a man with little or no concern for his own safety. There's the habitual lawbreaker who seems incapable of learning the error of his ways. Either that or he just didn't care. Paul was imprisoned multiple times during his ministry, spending, in total, an estimated 6 years behind bars. Was brutally flogged 5 times, receiving the maximum 39 lashes. Too many might kill a person. Was on 3 occasions beaten with rods. And was once, in the city of Lystra, in what is now modern Turkey, stoned by a mob so viciously that he was, by the time they were finished, given up for dead and dragged outside the city, as was the custom. Scripture records what happened next. But when the disciples gathered about him, he rose up and entered the city, and on the next day he went on with Barnabas to Derbe. Acts 14:20. Would you calmly re-enter a city whose inhabitants had just tried to stone you to death? Not sure I would. There's the peripatetic drifter who was continually on the move due to threats against his life. When the governor of Damascus placed a cordon around the city to arrest him, he made his escape in a basket through a gap in the city walls. There's the cold, calculating political mover and shaker, unafraid to tread on the feelings and sensibilities of others, no matter how important or personally loyal they were. Paul's bust-up with St. Peter in Antioch, in which he accused Peter to his face of being a hypocrite and forcing Gentiles to adopt Jewish customs when he himself lived like a Gentile, is described by L. Michael White, professor of classics and religious studies at the University of Texas at Austin, in his book From Jesus to Christianity, as a total failure of political bravado, and Paul soon left Antioch as persona non grata, never again to return. Finally, there's the remorseless, unblinking maneuvering of the psychological cat burglar, the silky smooth self-presentation skills of the expert manipulator. Recall the words of master con man Philip Morant. One of the most powerful weapons in the grifter's unholy arsenal is a good vulnerability radar. They could just as easily have been Paul's. Or, to put it another way, to the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people. 1 Corinthians 9:20-22. If it really was Jesus on that road to Damascus, and he wanted an emissary to help him spread the word, he couldn't have picked a better man for the job, nor, among Christians, a more feared or unpopular one. At the time of his conversion, Paul, without a doubt, was at the height of his persecutory powers. In fact, the very reason he was going to Damascus in the first place was to instigate more bloodshed. Coincidence that his ministry started there? Not all psychopaths are saints, and not all saints are psychopaths, but there's evidence to suggest that deep within the corridors of the brain, psychopathy and sainthood share secret neural office space, and that some psychopathic attributes, stoicism, the ability to regulate emotion, to live in the moment, to enter altered states of awareness, to be heroic, fearless, are also inherently spiritual in nature, and not only improve one's own well-being, but also that of others. If you need any convincing, You've just got to look at the Magdalen College prayer board once in a while. Seeing red swings it for the champion. The ability to smile in the face of adversity has long been regarded as a measure of spiritual intelligence. Take, for instance, the words of the poet Rudyard Kipling, "The last thing you see is a player before stepping out onto center court at Wimbledon. If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same." But though such a mindset is usually associated with saints, the link with psychopaths is somewhat less often conjectured. Derek Mitchell at University College London presented two groups of participants, psychopaths and non-psychopaths, with a procedure known as the Emotional Interrupt Task, EIT. The EIT is a reaction time test of discriminatory ability. Typically, volunteers sit in front of a computer screen and press keys with either their left or their right index fingers, depending on whether a particular kind of shape, usually a circle or a square, flashes up in front of them. Pretty simple, you might think. But in actual fact, the task can be rather tricky. The reason for this is that the shapes don't appear on their own. Instead, each circle or square is sandwiched for a couple of hundred milliseconds at a time between different pairs of images, usually faces. Either two positive images, smiling faces, two negative images, angry faces, or two neutral images, expressionless faces, respectively. Most people find the emotional images a problem simply because of that. They're emotional and distracting. But if, Mitchell hypothesized, psychopaths really are as unfazed and laid back as their reputations suggest, really can take the rough with the smooth, this shouldn't, in their case, be true. They should, in fact, respond faster and more accurately compared to controls, that is, they should be less distractible, on those trials where the circle or square is flanked by either two positive or two negative images. Images, in other words, that one way or another conceal an emotional valence. In contrast, Mitchell suggested, this difference between psychopaths and non-psychopaths should disappear on the neutral trials, where distraction is less of an issue. As it turned out, this is exactly what he found. Whenever the circle or square was flanked by an emotionally charged image, the psychopaths, exactly as predicted, were better at differentiating the targets than the non-psychopaths, and quicker, too. They were, as Kipling might have put it, better at keeping their heads while others were losing theirs. Stoicism is a quality much feted by society, and with good reason. It can come in handy in all sorts of ways, during bereavement, after a breakup, at the poker table, even at times when you're writing a book. But as a long-suffering follower of the England football team and a veteran of more penalty shootout debacles than I care to remember, it's the relationship between stoicism and sport that's perhaps most salient to me. And I'm not just talking from a spectator's point of view. As a psychological prism, sport is second to none in dispersing stoicism into its two constituent wavelengths, fearlessness and focus, which themselves comprise elements of both psychopathy and spiritual acumen. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Wrote St. Paul. Run in such a way as to get the prize. I am like a boxer who does not waste his punches. I harden my body with blows and bring it under complete control. That Kipling's words hang above center court is certainly no coincidence. Play like it means nothing when it means everything, replied the snooker legend Steve Davis when he was asked to spill the beans on sporting greatness. Let go of bad shots, and for that matter, good ones, and focus your attention 100% on the next one. The same is true in golf. In 2010, the South African Louis Oosthuizen was a rank outsider to win the British Open Championships at St. Andrews. After a string of disappointments in the events leading up to the tournament, he was fully expected, even with a four-shot lead, to crack under the pressure of the cutthroat final round. But he didn't. And the reason for that was surprisingly, though deceptively, simple. a small red spot conspicuously located just below the base of his thumb on his glove. The idea of the spot came from Carl Morris, a Manchester-based sports psychologist who was called in by Oosthuizen to help him touch base with what one might reasonably describe as his hidden inner psychopath. The goal was to center his mind on playing the shot at hand, rather than obsessing, at exactly the wrong moment, about the consequences. So Morris devised a plan. Whenever Oosthuizen was about to take a swing, he was to focus his attention calmly and steadily on the dot. The dot was all that mattered at that point in time. He wasn't to play the shot. The shot, instead, was to play him. He won by 7 strokes. Oosthuizen's red spot is a classic example of what's known in sports psychology as a process goal, a technique by which the athlete is required to focus on something, however minor, to prevent them from thinking about other things. In Oosthuizen's case, all the ways he could possibly screw up the shot. It anchors the athlete firmly in the here and now, before the shot is actually played, before the move is actually made, and most importantly of all, before confidence begins to fade. In fact, this ability to concentrate purely on the task at hand, what the Hungarian psychologist Mihai Csikszentmihalyi calls optimal experience or flow, is one of a number of key techniques that performance psychologists now work on, not just in golf, but among high-level competitors in all areas of sport. In moments of flow, the past and the future evaporate as abstractions. All that remains is an intense, uncanny, attention-devouring present, an overwhelming feeling of being in the zone. This is the union, the enchanted consummation of mind, body, and game, what's known in the trade as the golden triangle of performance. A trance-like state of effortless action and reaction, where time and self converge, and one is in control but not in control at the same time. In 2011, Martin Claesson at Aachen University discovered that moments of flow have a unique neural signature. Using fMRI to observe the brains of video game players in action, he found that periods of heightened focus and concentration are accompanied by a reduction of activity in the anterior cingulate cortex, the brain's error detection and conflict monitoring hardware, indicative of an increase in attention and the suppression of distracting and non-task-relevant information. But a similar pattern has also been found in the brains of criminal psychopaths. In the same year that Claesson was playing video games, Kent Keel dusted off that 18-wheel fMRI juggernaut of his and hit the roads of New Mexico armed with a new experiment. Keel was interested in what precisely makes psychopaths tick when it comes to moral decision-making. Are they really ice-cool under pressure? Are they really better at coming up with the goods when the chips are down and time is of the essence? If so, why? Could it possibly be something that's hardwired into their brains, a triumph of cold-blooded cognitive reasoning over warm-blooded emotional processing? To find out, he presented psychopaths and non-psychopaths with 2 different types of moral dilemmas, what he termed high-conflict personal and low-conflict personal dilemmas, respectively, examples of both of which follow. High-conflict personal. Enemy soldiers have taken over your village. They have orders to kill everyone they find. You and some others are hiding in a basement. You hear the soldiers enter the house above you. Your baby begins to cry loudly. You cover his mouth to block the sound. If you remove your hand from his mouth, he will cry loudly and the soldiers will hear. If they hear the baby, they will find you and kill everyone, including you and your baby. To save yourself and the others, you must smother your baby to death. Is it morally acceptable for you to smother your child in order to save yourself and the other people? Low conflict, personal. You are visiting your grandmother for the weekend. Usually she gives you a gift of a few dollars when you arrive, but this time she doesn't. You ask her why not, and she says something about how you don't write her as many letters as you used to. You get angry and decide to play a trick on her. You take some pills from the medicine cabinet and put them in your grandmother's teapot, thinking that this will make her very sick. Is it morally acceptable for you to put pills in your grandmother's teapot in order to play a trick on her? The prediction was simple. If psychopaths were less fazed by the extraneous emotional exigencies of the moment and had the cold, hard edge over the rest of us when it came to life and death decision-making, then the most marked difference between their performance and that of the non-psychopaths, Keel surmised, should manifest itself when it came to the high-conflict personal dilemmas, when the heat is turned up to max and the problem is closest to home. This, it turned out, is exactly what he found. In the high-conflict scenarios, the psychopaths did, indeed, rate a significantly greater number of utilitarian judgments as morally acceptable than the non-psychopaths. They were better at smothering babies, or at least dealing with the pain of such an action, than their more ethically squeamish counterparts. And presumably, they would be better at staying alive and preserving the lives of their fellow basement stowaways, were the scenarios to play out for real. But there was more. Just as I had found with the William Brown example in Chapter 3, Keel and his co-workers also discovered that the psychopaths, as well as having fewer moral hygiene issues in general than the non-psychopaths, took considerably less time to evaluate the conundrums put in front of them. They were quicker at reaching a decision as to the appropriate course of action. Not only that, but such attenuated response times were accompanied, just as Clayson had found under conditions of flow, by reduced activity in the anterior cingulate cortex. But, and here's the rub, only when it came to the high-conflict scenarios. In the case of the low-conflict dilemmas, the deliberative differential disappeared. Psychopaths were just as likely to veto the idea of putting pills in your grandmother's teapot as the non-psychopaths. The conclusion seems pretty clear. When the stakes are high and backs are against the wall, it's a psychopath you want alongside you. But if there's nothing to play for, and you're on an even keel, forget it. Psychopaths switch off and take just as much time getting the show on the road as the rest of us. Indeed, EEG studies have revealed consistent differences in the way the brains of psychopaths and non-psychopaths respond to tasks and situations that are either highly interesting or highly motivating, respectively. When the writing's on the wall, psychopaths show significantly greater activation in the left prefrontal regions of their brains, the area directly behind the left forehead, compared to non-psychopaths. Cerebral asymmetry associated with considerable reduction in anxiety, enhanced positive effect, increased focusing of attention and orientation to reward, and also, it would seem, with elevated spiritual states. The neuroscientist Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin has discovered precisely the same profile in elite Buddhist monks, the spiritual Olympians of the High Himalaya, while they're immersed in deep meditation. There is a lot of evidence to suggest that the best sportsmen and women have developed psychological skills that allow them to concentrate and to control anxiety, explains Tim Rees, a sports psychologist at the University of Exeter. Moreover, he adds, there is also a lot of evidence to show that once someone gets to a certain level of skill, it is the differences in their psychological approach that differentiates people at the very top. The mindset that separates the great from the good and, as Kent Keel showed us, in some critical situations, the living from the dead, is inherently psychopathic in nature and also inherently spiritual. Stop all the clocks. The link made by Csikszentmihalyi and others between staying in the present and the absence of anxiety is, of course, hardly new. The practice of right mindfulness, for example, constitutes the seventh step of the Noble Eightfold Path, one of the principal teachings of Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, some 2,500 years ago. In his book, The Noble Eightfold Path, the way to the end of suffering, Bhikkhu Bodhi, a monk of the Theravada tradition, describes what the practice entails. The mind is deliberately kept at the level of bare attention, a detached observation of what is happening within us and around us in the present moment. In the practice of right mindfulness, the mind is trained to remain in the present, open, quiet, and alert, contemplating the present event. All judgments and interpretations have to be suspended, or if they occur, just registered and dropped. According to the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, one of the core discourses in the Pali canon of Theravada Buddhism, such training, consistently applied, eventually leads to the arising of insight and the qualities of dispassion, non-clinging, and release. Psychopaths, as we've seen, possess such qualities naturally. But the similarities between the Western psychopathic mentality and the transcendental mindsets of the East don't end there. More recently, psychologists such as Mark Williams at the University of Oxford, who, if you recall, we met in the previous chapter, and the aforementioned Richard Davidson have begun the innovative, integrative, though empirically demanding process of harnessing the restorative properties of Buddhist meditation practices within a more systematized, therapeutic, and clinically oriented framework. So far, it seems to be working. Mindfulness-based intervention, as we saw a little earlier, has been shown to be a particularly effective metacognitive strategy when dealing with the symptoms of anxiety and depression, two conditions that psychopaths are singularly immune to. The fundamental principles of the therapy, as one would expect, are heavily derivative of the traditional Buddhist teachings already outlined. But there's an added ingredient, a kind of naive, childlike inquisitiveness, which is strongly reminiscent of the core openness to experience factor of the Big Five personality structure that we explored in Chapter 2, and which psychopaths, if you recall, score very high on. The first component of mindfulness involves the self-regulation of attention so that it is maintained on immediate experience, explained psychiatrist Scott Bishop in one of the seminal papers on the subject back in 2004, thereby allowing for increased recognition of mental events in the present moment. The second component involves adopting a particular orientation toward one's experiences in the present moment, an orientation that is characterized by curiosity, openness, and acceptance. Or, as the Zen Buddhist masters of the martial arts would say, Shoshin, beginner's mind. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, elucidated Shunryu Suzuki, one of the most celebrated Buddhist teachers of recent times. In the expert's mind, there are few. And few would disagree. When Dickens decided to send Scrooge the ghosts of the past, present, and future, he chose the three specters that haunt all of us. But anchor your thoughts entirely in the present. Screen out the chatter of the querulous, recriminative past and the elusive, importunate future, and anxiety begins to subside. Perception begins to sharpen, and the question becomes one of utility. What we do with this now, this enormous, emphatic present, once we have it? Do we savor the moment like a saint, or seize it like a psychopath? Do we reflect on the nature of experience, or do we focus our attention entirely on ourselves in the frenetic pursuit of instant gratification? Several years ago now, I traveled to a remote monastery in Japan in search of the answer to a mystery. The mystery in question concerned a test undertaken by those on the rarefied spiritual ice fields of the higher martial arts. The test involves one man kneeling down, arms by his side, blindfolded, while another man stands behind him with a samurai sword raised aloft. At a moment of his choosing, undisclosed to his vulnerable adversary, the man standing behind will bring down the sword onto the kneeling man's head, causing injury, probably death. Unless, that is, the blow is somehow deflected, and the swordsman subsequently disarmed. Such a feat appears impossible, and yet it isn't. The test I have just described is real, an ancient, exquisitely choreographed ritual carried out in secret, unfathomable dojos in Japan and the high Himalaya that those approaching greatness, those spectral mind whisperers miles above the black belt, undergo. These days, mercifully, the sword is made of plastic, but there was a time, long before the days of health and safety, when it was the real thing. A shadowy sensei, well into his 80s, revealed the secret. One must empty one's mind totally, he told me, as we sat cross-legged in a garden of clouds and lilac, deep in the ancient beech forests of the Tanzawa Mountains. One must focus purely on the now. When one enters a state like that, one is able to smell time, to feel its waves washing over one's senses. The tiniest ripple may be detected over great distances and the signal intercepted. Often it appears that the two combatants move simultaneously, but this is not so. It is not difficult. With practice, it can be mastered. Reading back over what the ancient sensei told me, I'm strongly reminded of the words of the psychopathic neurosurgeon we encountered in Chapter 4. Of course, I hadn't met him by the time I went to Japan, but if I had, I would have recounted his description of how he sometimes feels before a difficult operation with great alacrity to my host. And the old man in his monastic black hakama and blood-red kimono would have smiled. The surgeon's account of the mental state he calls supersanity, an altered state of consciousness that feeds on precision and clarity, appears very similar to the frame of mind that the sensei was talking about, the mind state that must be entered into by the kneeling, blindfolded time sommelier to disarm his sword-wielding assailant. One is also reminded of the work of Joe Newman, who, if you'll recall, in his lab at the University of Wisconsin, has shown that it isn't so much the case that psychopaths don't feel anxiety in certain situations, but rather that they just don't notice the threat. Their attention is focused purely on the task at hand, and extraneous distractors are ruthlessly filtered out. Usually, of course, when it comes to psychopaths, such focus is construed as malevolent, the glacial, guiltless killer cruising the city limits like some gas-guzzling praying mantis in search of the perfect victim, the genocidal dictator, oblivious to the rule of moral or civil law, hell-bent on silencing all dissenting opinion in his indomitable quest for culture and political omnipotence. Compassionate, transcendental, or spiritual connotations are rarely, if ever, considered. But a number of studies have recently begun to shed new light on such a resoundingly unlikely possibility, and have begun to precipitate a gradual yet fundamental reevaluation of precisely what it means to be a psychopath.
And we will get all of that next Friday as we wrap up Kevin Dutton's The Wisdom of Psychopaths, Gus T. Renegade. We did our two sessions for this week. Folks have commentary on the second portion, what we heard of Chapter 7, the number to dial, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If folks have commentary they would like to share, anything stood out as significant from the second portion of the reading, feel free. Line should be open. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
So I didn't have as many notes on this one, or at least I can find it. At least two things that stuck out to me was that it seems like there's a lot of maybe not a lot, but there are at least a few examples where where the author, Mr. Dutton, is putting these scenarios where you have to kill someone in order to save the rest of, you know, the other people. And it definitely really helps me to better understand that they don't, you know, it seems like white people, especially the ones who practice racism, they definitely have a clear understanding of, I guess, what maybe some people will call collateral, I don't know if it's called collateral damage, or where they're willing to sacrifice, you know, basically like what he keeps bringing up, sacrificing some to save other people. And just like the part with the baby, that story was definitely, you know, disturbing, at least to me. Like, I don't understand, you know, why you would have to take it that far to kill a child, just to, you know, prove a point that, you know, well, this is, you know, is it really a psychopath if you have to kill your child to save, or kill a child to save to save other people? And on page 198, he had said that when the stakes are high and backs are against the wall, it's a psychopath you want alongside you. And I feel like that definitely seems like something, an ideology that a racist would go by. And if they are fearing genetic annihilation, then, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they do feel like at all times their backs are against the wall, so all of them have to operate as psychopaths. And the last thing I'll say is that I remember when I was reading it, it seemed like I was, you know, I guess somewhat happy or relieved or whatever that he finally got to including some sort of a saint within the text. It just seems like to me he's definitely glorifying psychopaths instead of just only pointing out the good attributes. It almost seems like, you know, you want everybody to be a psychopath, especially when back in the text when he was saying, well, he was excited about going through the test with some other professor or teacher or something, that the teacher or whoever had came up with some type of a test to kind of make people temporarily psychopathic. So that's all I have for now. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Appreciate that, Red in Nevada. That's a great point, because Saints, that is in the subtitle. The book is The Wisdom of Psychopaths, What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. And there was not a whole lot of time spent on the sainthood aspect. That is real late, it seems, in the book. There's much more time glorifying the likes of Jamie from the detention center before, and Charles Manson, Jeffrey Dahmer, different killers, white killers, emphasis on white. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, Emmy, Mel, lines should be open. If you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everyone. This may sound strange, but I think that the text is really constructive, not just for examining white people and how white people function, but like something that I'm coming to view as fact is any entity, organism that doesn't evolve dies. Like that's part of life. When I'm studying, I just observe that all the time. And I'm not necessarily saying that black people need to become psychopaths. I don't think that would be the direction that we need to move in order to solve our problem. I do, however, think that if you're dealing with this psychopath, then there's a lot to learn from them. And so some of the things that he talks about, like entering that Zen zone, asking some of those really tough questions, like, I would be, you know, we'll never know, never, ever really know But I wonder how many non-white people were in that exact same situation where they had a crying baby and were being chased by white people, and like what choices were made, you know, when enslaved folks here like fled or tried to flee, you know. I think those kind of thinking about those questions can be constructive. I had a bunch of notes. I didn't actually get to participate in like the two previous readings, nor was I able to listen in on the first half. Unfortunately, I was on the plantation and couldn't listen. But I do think that there's a lot of truth revealed, especially in when we're talking about evolution. And I only focus on that because in all the bio classes, like that is essentially, you know, whether you want to evolve or not doesn't necessarily mean, like, you're always evolving. It's just a matter of into what. And so white people, I think, glorify this. And so, like, this is what we're dealing with. And just being able to embody some of those characteristics, I do think, would be extremely helpful for non-white people, like in everyday life, but then also in the larger view of replacing a system of white supremacy with a system of justice. I think, you know, I felt it coming, and not so much because of the title, although I think I don't even think I paid any attention to the title, but this whole dichotomy between this God and devil, and I thought it was fascinating. I wasn't actually able to read, so I've only been listening, but he made a connection and pretty much was like, God's a psychopath. Did I hear that correctly? And if so, I just thought like this whole last second section just felt like welding all the time, just going off every time he said something. And yeah, I think I'll stop for there, and then I'll actually see if I can find some of my notes from before and share. But that way I leave room for other people to talk. So thank you for listening.
Indeed. Appreciate that, Emmy. Mel, did you have commentary you wanted to get in?
I do. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Oh, Lord. In the section, Saint Peter the Psychopath, I was thinking that I thought it was bad earlier when he said that something, it basically became a whole section on where Charles Manson was an irresistible, like, smooth talker. And then this last section the first section in this reading where he was talking about the rich traders and their fancy driveways and their million-dollar questions. And then and I'm not sure if it's revisionist history, because I've heard that there are different versions of the Bible, but the usage of biblical passages in Buddhist texts just seems like an attempt to deify psychopathy. I mean, just straight out. And it is strange to me as well that it came up far at the very like tail end of the book, even though it's in the title. On another note, there were some smaller, strange usages of words that I picked up on. I think at some point he says that, I believe psychopaths have a quote-unquote vulnerability radar. And I would say that this is a negative predatory lens, not a vulnerability radar, but a negative predatory lens through which they prey on other people. I wouldn't call it a vulnerability radar. Like, there's just vulnerability and you're just picking up on it. It seems like you're stalking people if you're a psychopath. Maybe it's just me. And then I think he said right after that vulnerability radar was like silky smooth something. I thought it was silky smooth persuasion. That just sounded like an R&B song title. But some parts of this reading section and of the text overall really feel like the wisdom of people who just focus really hard on whatever it is they are doing. I'm not sure exactly how the video game players related to psychopaths necessarily, for instance. I say necessarily because he said that they have certain brain activity while playing games and that brain activity indicates great focus. But he could have just said that certain parts of the brain are related to focus and this is how. He didn't actually have to bring video game players into the mix. And I think that there is a need to blanket more people than are necessary to be psychopathic. Or labeled as psychopathic. Like I believe the first female caller said, it seems like he wants to pull more people under the psychopathic umbrella than possibly actually exist, and to sort of normalize it, I think. Similarly, the part about do I save the most amount of people or my baby, and that utilitarian sort of example, I was thinking, like, there's really no need to be emotionless if you smother your baby. I think he said that, too, in the context. And it's, I mean, it's, the scenario misses the context of whether everyone next to you is pressuring you to smother your baby. I guess that's just an unwarranted question to ask. But I kind of want to label that a psychopathic scenario to put people in, but I'm not sure. Like, it does make me think about the people who administer these tests that he alleges have occurred. And then, I guess, piggybacking on your point, Gus, about the author really does seem to have just the availability to travel around for this book and to pull at the coattails, I think, of other cultures. I think in this section he's been to Japan, and in the last section he was in Europe. I'm not sure if he was physically there or just researching. It sounds like he was there. And I was wondering to myself, had he been to the continent of Africa in this book yet, or really has he mentioned African Americans at all? I'm not really recalling earlier sections of the book if he did. That was all of my points for right now.
I think we got a Tiger Woods reference way, way back some time ago. But other than that, I don't recall too many dark people, if any, being mentioned in the text at all. And that line where he used Silky Smooth, it was talking about St. Paul. And it was the silky smooth self-presentation skills of the expert manipulator. That was the sentence. Quite an alliteration with those S's there for the psychopath. And I think it was Emmy, when she was giving her commentary before Mel spoke, where she was saying, did Dutton in the text in the portion of chapter 7 that we just heard, did he say that God was a psychopath? There were two portions. There was the very beginning, when he was, I guess, telling this funny anecdote, this guy wrote this letter to God about, I think he said something to the effect of, if you let me win the lottery, you'll never hear from me again. And God responds with this kind of witty letter. And he says that God has turned the dials, where he keeps talking about that, on these attributes of a psychopath, where he says God, who's not afraid to twiddle those dials on the mixing desk up and down when the situation calls for it. That seemed to me to be attributing psychopathic qualities to God. And then it happens again, where he's saying that the saint and the psychopath could really be one, two sides of the same coin, and that they share a lot of the same similar brain activity for some of their concentration and focus that they do in trying to get things done. So there are at least two portions in the section that we've read thus far in chapter 7, where it seems like he is comparing God to a psychopath, or calling God a psychopath, or at least the characteristics of a psychopath, and then saints as well. Some of the things that stood out from this portion, where he says, when Western civilization subscribed to the traditional bourgeois mores of hard work and virtue seeking, the psychopath was confined to the margins of mainstream society. He was condemned by his fellow right-minded citizens as either a madman or an outlaw. Now, I read that and I just thought, wow, that is, you know, in my view, active racism, white supremacy, and the assessment of Western civilization, white people, white culture. Now, subscribing to traditional bourgeois mores of hard work, we're talking about people who enslaved millions of folks, the system of white supremacy being a system of slavery, but shackles and whatnot, enslavement of people to say that they are about hard work. And even within a system of white supremacy, saying that psychopaths were confined to the margins of mainstream society, looking at all of the barbarous conduct that whites have inflicted upon non-white people worldwide for centuries. What are you talking about? Whites have been unleashed to do whatever they want to non-white people all over the world. That hasn't been confined to the closets or anything to be ashamed about. They brag about that sort of thing all the time. I think that sort of inaccurate assessment of white history, white culture, where they still are glorified as though at some time their behavior, their conduct was about justice and hard work and treating people correctly and not allowing psychopaths, the Charles Mansons and Jeffrey Dahmers, to run amok and terrorize the world. That is nonsense. That's what they've been about forever. Continuing, let's see. The next one, we've heard this name so many times in the book club over the years. Rudyard Kipling, he puts all this time and energy into making sure that we know that Rudyard Kipling's name and his poem or sentence or what have you from his writing is inscribed at the stadium at Wimbledon. For folks, Rudyard Kipling, he wrote The Jungle Book, turned into a movie by Disney and what have you. He also wrote White Man's Burden, a very famous poem talking about the system of white supremacy and the labor. Exactly what I was just saying, really, white people being allowed to stomp all over the world to dominate, terrorize in the name of white supremacy. But Rudyard Kipling, one of the most esteemed white authors with, I would say, the ideology of racism, white supremacy in his way, even his children's books, The Jungle Book, for God's sake. But he gets mentioned all the time in our book club and in different books. You can go back and see how often his name comes up. I thought it was major Welsing moment. There are so many ball game references where Dr. Welsing talks about the importance of ball games to white people. And there's so many ball game references where he's just in the portion that we talked about this week, where the inmates at the detention center, they keep playing this soccer game, football, in this chapter 7, where he's talking about this South African golf player who has got his skills and everything so that he can concentrate and win the golf game, hitting the little white ball, just continuing to come up over and over again. The sports, ball games, the competition, even the sentence that he started chapter 6 with from Sherlock Holmes, where he said, see if I can read it really quick. He said, or the quote from Sherlock Holmes was, "Sentiment is a chemical aberration found on the losing side." Sentiment, feelings, right? Emotions is for losers, basically. And I thought that was significant. The word that really stuck out to me was losing. Everything somehow is a competition. Winners, losers, and of course, the blonde white man, white woman, white child, they are supposed to be on the winning side. And the dark folks, they are supposed to be the losers. But that just coming up so many different ways in the text. Competition, that's what this is. This is not about cooperation. This is not about justice. This is the competition. We're supposed to have winners, whites, and losers, whether it's soccer, tennis, everything. That mantra of it is a race. It is about racism, white supremacy, white domination at all times. Keep your mind on that at all times. Dr. Welsing thinks she would emphasize that tremendously with all the focus on the ball games. Did other folks have anything else they wanted to make sure they commented on before we get ready to wrap up the book study session? Any other comments that we missed? Retired firefighter, do you have commentary you wanted to get in, sir? Retired firefighter, you just listening, or did you have commentary as well?
I was just listening.
Cool in the gang. Other folks with a hand up, any other comments folks wanted to make sure they got in?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I forgot to mention, I had actually found a documentary on YouTube about Broadmoor. And I just thought that it was interesting. There's actually I don't think they showed I forgot the name of the unit that he was on. I think was it like the DVM? But they didn't actually, I don't recall them going into the type of unit. But the main thing that I remember, and it helped me to actually get visualize it more as I was reading through the passage. But it seemed like most of the harder work, the more hands-on work that you have to do with some of the psychopathic or psychotic patients were done by, they seemed to be black people, very highly melanated black people. And then the ones who, of course, didn't really have to do that much work, the ones who are actually talking to the document, the filmmakers, they were mainly the white people. So I just thought that was interesting how Broadmoor almost seemed like they may have been practicing racism, white supremacy. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Hmm. Interesting. That might be worth checking out the Broadmoor documentary just to see where he was at. And I think Mel picked up on that as well, but I also had that as well. Him skipping around to all these different facilities and going to Japan to study from. I mean, just wow. Like, that is the life and times of racist man, racist woman, racist child. And that is the whole world as the white man's brothel. We had that before as well from one of our previous guests on the program. But yeah, just, I mean, you can just globe trot and go wherever you want to do your little studies and things. I think he had a researcher earlier who had their little RV set up so that they could go around and conduct their studies to different facilities and get all the people that they needed for their experiments and what have you. That is the system of racism, white supremacy. That is, again, massive power differential in being able to go out and get all this information and compile so that you can get a much better understanding of how this system works, what you need to do to tweak it, unless I'm, you know, way off in my assessment. Other comments folks want to make sure they get in? Any other assessments?
Yes, just to reiterate on what you just said, white people's ability to expand the system of racism to just about everywhere that people are thinking about or have gone to or who wants to go to. I think they're going to Mars right now, attempting that way anyway. And that's just something that they do. That's I would say a uniqueness about what it is culturally to be a white person, is to travel around and spread their pestilence wherever they are. That's been my observation anyway.
Dig it. Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Any other folks have comments they wanted to make sure they get in? Groovy. Soon folks are satisfied. Again, we will be wrapping the book up next Friday, I think, unless I'm really off, but I looked at the pages. I think, yeah, we'll be done next Friday. All we have is chapter 7, and we will be all done. Even that Rudyard Kipling quote, the one that's allegedly at the stadium at Wimbledon, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, all of that directed at the system of racism, white supremacy, where they're presenting it as you're supposed to be clear and focused and be in the moment. All of that is without confusion or ambiguity connected to white domination. And I'm very sure if you go around and talk to the white people at Wimbledon and ask them, oh, do you know who Rudyard Kipling is? I'm quite sure that a substantial chunk of those folks, oh yeah, I know who he is. We've had to read him. I know about White Man's Burden. Absolutely. They get their little reminder cues all the time about what they're supposed to be focused on, what this is really all about. I mean, oh yeah, we can come in here and clap and cheer and, oh yeah, maybe Serena Williams will win. Maybe we'll call her a nigger. Maybe we won't call her a nigger today. But either way, all of this is really about not just wagging on this ball here on the court. All of this is about global white domination, period. Do not forget that. Do not get confused ever. They don't. We don't understand the game. Even when it looks like we're doing well, we do not understand at all. With that, folks satisfied? Everybody good?
That's fantastic. Do you have...
I'm sorry.
We'll go ahead, ma'am.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to quickly say just the title of the YouTube documentary that I watched. It's called Broadmoor Inside the Entire Security Psychiatric Hospital, the documentary, and it was posted by purplechicken.tv. It's from June of 2015, just in case if anyone wanted to look it up. It's about an hour and a half, and I'll meet my line. Thank you.
What's the name of it again?
It is called Broadmoor, inside of Britain's highest security psychiatric hospital. It was posted by purplechicken.tv. It's dated June of 2015, and it's an hour and 37 minutes.
Awesome. I found it online. I'll put the link on the Facebook page so folks can check it out. Good looking, red in Nevada. Retired firefighter?
Oh, I was just wondering right quick if you had an idea of what the next book you were going to be reading.
I have not made a decision. If folks have suggestions, feel free. You can email or what have you. If there's something that you think we should read, I was thinking they certainly have biographies on Charles Manson. He had just passed away. I was thinking Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. That's a really popular one that I think a lot of people at least know about, even though I suspect there are a sizable chunk of folks who've not read that book yet, including Gus T. Homegoing. That was another one that was really popular, written by an African author. I think that is fiction, though, but really, really popular. Got a lot of attention towards the middle of last year. Those were some of the books I was thinking, but again, not decided. If folks have something that they would like to read, feel free, chime in. We still have, you know, time to decide. So once we get it figured out, I will let folks know.
Yeah, those sound like two good, it sound like several good suggestions. I was just thinking about Mr. Beach, and I looked on his website, and he has a book. I think it's something close to an autobiography. I thought when he came on, it was a pretty good program, and I'd be interested in reading, you know, more about him as a person or whatever thoughts he may have in the book.
Mr. Beach's book is great. I don't know if he has multiple. I did read his autobiography when he came on the program. And lots of direct, explicit information on racism, white supremacy. And that is a short one. Very, very short book. That's one. Well, depending on your free time, you probably knock that one out in one day because it's not real big.
Oh, okay. It's real short. Okay. Yes, I was going to buy it. Yeah.
Worth the buy. Worth the buy. Gus T. Renegade gives it two thumbs up. Two enthusiastic thumbs up. Mr. Walter Beach III. With that, did we nab everybody? Anybody else have a question or a comment they needed to get in? Grant, again, if you have thoughts on the next book, feel free, drop an email, let me know. We'll make a decision. We have time. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, slowly kind of getting ourselves back on schedule, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. If you have questions, guest suggestions, gripes, complaints, problems, feel free, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. I know there is an issue with some of the archives, some of the older archives from years back not being accessed, but I'm slowly going through and checking and re-uploading the audio. If there is an issue to correct it, it will take a little bit of time given all the massive disruptions I've had over the past couple of months, but I am aware of that and slowly working on resolving that issue as well. You can be patient or you can let me know if there's specific archives if you're having trouble accessing a particular broadcast. With that, thanks for all the folks tuning in. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. And we will be back next week to wrap up Mr. Dutton's The Wisdom of Psychopaths. I will again encourage sobriety. Certainly would be best under conditions of racism, white supremacy. Racists have done a lot of damage, terrorizing black people, non-white people, when we are not thinking clearly, not able to maximize our brain potential, brain computers, because we're intoxicated. I know it's the weekend, people want to get out and frolic and all of that. Yeah, yeah, war is being waged against us. I think it would behoove us to make sure that we can make phenomenal decisions. He was talking about mindfulness, and in my opinion, just being able to follow the logic, make great decisions. I think you'll be able to do all of that to a much greater capacity not being under the influence of any of White's drugs, poisons, narcotics. We can save a few coins as well. Certainly, you do not want to be in a vehicle under the influence and have that be the time that you get stopped by Daniel Holtzclaw or any other raping race soldier where you're intoxicated. I do not think you're going to make great decisions. I do not think that's going to put you in any of us in a position to get home safely. Let's just keep that in mind. And certainly buckle up if you're going to be in a vehicle. Buckle up. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.